and welcome to episode 79 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the show where small press makes one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of the comic series The Red Mouse from Mars, and joining me is the comic artist, writer and creator of the webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
Hello.
Writer, Down the Tubes contributor, Always Trouble, and our very own boiled egg, Tony Esmond.
Thank you, from the Bald Egg Nation.
And this week we're also joined by an illustrator whose work has been showcased in many an indie title, but he's also currently working on an epic sci-fi opus of his own. That book is called The Big Couch, and that artist is Matt Harrower.
Hey! Yeah, finally, Harrower, we've talked you into coming on.
Yeah.
And he seems really excited about it.
To be fair, you've actually been on twice. You came on with the infamous Vampirella cosplay interview that we did with you. And you were briefly on during the Thought Bubble from 2015 when I was shouting at you and you refused to be interviewed. Do you remember?
I remember running away.
Very wise, Matt. I don't blame you.
Yes, yeah. Third time.
Vampirella one's the highlight of the show.
Yeah, still our favourite. Yeah.
Fucking gold.
Oh dear. Matt's been a friend of the show since day one, but it's taken us years to break him down enough until he'd come onto the podcast to talk comics. As you can tell, he is a broken man, but he's here and ready to talk comics nonetheless. So thank you, Matt.
No worries. I'm glad to be here.
Do you want us to keep Tony off you for this whole, for the next 2 hours?
No, that's fine. No,
it's he gets right. better than that. And his girlfriend's scary. Oh, Dash is going to call me now, isn't she?
Yes.
She will, yeah. Luckily, she's gone out.
So, no, she'll listen back, though.
Yeah, she will.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
We love Tash.
Yeah. R.I.P. Tony.
Yeah, whatever brings the listener numbers up, that's all I care about.
Everyone get their girlfriends to listen now, please.
This is the first show of 2017.
I know, our third year.
Yeah.
Our third year of existence. That's three years longer than most people probably thought would happen. But, and we're gonna start strong. Now, Tony and Dan, do you think it was this week's subject matter that convinced Matt to join us?
I think so.
I think so. Who wouldn't want to discuss this? Hey? For those of you out there who don't know what I'm talking about, and you probably don't, because especially if you're catching up on episodes like some people do, you have no idea what this one's about. A little while ago, we had a bit of a crazy idea. As always, these crazy ideas normally stem from Daniel Butcher. It was a dark, twisted idea that could shake the very foundations of the comics industry. So we decided to look back on some older comics, give them a read, and then give our fresh, new and modern hipster opinions on what we think of them.
That's us, fucking hipsters.
Yeah. We're the modern hipster gangsters. That's what we are. But the thing is, the comics that we're going to talk about, they're all from an era that's got quite a reputation. It's the 1990s. Or the 90s, as some people call it.
Some crazy people.
I read a book about the 1990s about McFarlane and Image, and they called it the Dark Ages.
Oh, see, yeah, it does have quite a reputation
now. I think that's pretty apt.
Yeah.
Well,
as well as all that, though, it was a decade that saw some of the biggest selling books of all time. Let's not forget. It had the industry changing creation of Image for once. Hollow foil covers. Chrome covers.
Trading cards.
I'm going to talk about them in a minute. I've got
Wizard magazine. Die cut covers. Yeah. The Spider-Man clone saga. That was in the 90s, wasn't it?
Was the pullout at the back of your issue have the pullout of what's coming out in the next few months or month or so? They had a pullout at the back of the issues. Was that in the 90s?
Yeah, I think that was done.
Yeah, I think that was it was late 90s, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's typically more fold-out stuff and kind of wraparound covers.
Yeah.
Now, looking back on it, when you take the time to actually look back on it, loads of stuff happened in the 90s. Obviously, it was a boom period, wasn't it, for comics?
Yeah.
Which therefore led to the sort of self-implosion, etc., etc., etc. But we're not going to bore you with all that nonsense, because what we wanted to do on this show was look at some of those old comics and, for once, How would you describe it, Dan Butcher? How would you describe what we're going to talk about?
Take a massive shit on them. It's not talking about the like bright side of the night. It's just the worst bits.
Yes, we thought we'd pick some comics that had to be seen to be believed. For instance, we love comics, and we try to love all comics, but some stuff you just can't wrap your head around.
We've had a few issues, haven't we, saying that there's a lot of good comics in the 90s, and I will wholeheartedly agree with that. I read and loved comics throughout the 90s. There's a few that I feel like someone has literally reached into my pocket and stolen money off me for.
Yeah,
and they are the ones we're going to talk about.
Yeah, we'll probably discuss, obviously, it's going to be funny what we're going to be talking about, but afterwards we'll talk a bit about other 90s comics as well, because we're not all about the hate. And I don't know about some of you out there, but I personally, when I really sort of got bitten by the bug of comics, it was the 90s. You know,
that was
my teens and stuff. So that was the heyday. So even though there was all of this stuff that we look back on now and just think, oh my God, at the time, I was thinking, you know, I had blinders to some of it, thinking it was like cool. You know, it was cool and new, and I hadn't seen this before. Of course, now I look back and think, oh God.
Look back on it and it's just utterly vapid. There's just no substance to any of it.
Yeah.
And I found I didn't know back then, like trying to read it as a story, I didn't really make sense of it. And going back looking at it as an adult now, like the storytelling aspects of it on some of the comics is just terrible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I didn't some of them I bought, this is genuinely how I felt at the time, is a lot of the, especially the Image stuff and some of the other stuff came out, and I bought it because I thought everyone's going mental for this stuff. It must be good. Almost like was brainwashed into thinking, well, it must be good, so I'm going to buy it. And then I read it and I thought, this, I don't understand why this is, but it started off for the New Mutants Liefeld run for me. And I read that and I thought, I don't understand why everyone says this is brilliant. I really don't. And that's not me trying to be cool and looking back and saying, oh, yeah, I'm so cool. But I'm not. I genuinely at the time thought, what the fuck is all this? But like a lemming, I bought it all. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, me too. I kept on convincing myself this was good.
Yeah.
I thought, this is all right. This is good. And then...
But sometimes that's the nature of art, isn't it? Sometimes it does take you a while to realise something is good in all areas of art. And maybe that was what I was trying to give it some time to realise, you know? There's some artists you almost got to warm to, aren't there? You know, I didn't, and a lot of this I just didn't fucking warm to it at all. But you know, some of it did. But, you know,
and also some artists, they obviously hit a certain stride in the 90s, but it's not until the modern stuff that you like their work, or you know, and vice versa. Yeah. I mean, certainly during Image, I was not a fan of Jay Lee's work. You know, it was sort of too jagged and sort of an aggressive style, if you know what I mean. But seeing some of the stuff he's done on the Dark Tower series, and look, you know, some of these Marvel
covers, fantastic.
It's beautiful stuff.
Yeah, that before Watchmen stuff he did was lovely. Yeah, really nice.
Yeah,
yeah,
really nice. So it's interesting how careers have certainly sort of taken off or sort of stayed where they are since then. But never mind about that. We're going to be talking about some books and ripping into them. So should we just get stuck in?
Yeah. Okay.
Who wants to go first? This is going to be funny.
Shall I go first?
Go first, Tony.
Yeah.
What have you got? Right.
Well, firstly, just a little shout out to Chris and Reggie at Weird Science DC Podcast, who completely coincidentally did an episode recently on Youngblood 1, where they did some of the voices as well. And I highly recommend going to that and having a laugh, because it had me chuckling on the train. Very, very good it was.
Which podcast was that again?
It's called Weird Science DC Podcast. And Chris and Reggie run it, two top blokes. Most of the stuff they do is about the history of comics, which I really, you know, because it's me, I really enjoy that stuff. But this, they just said, like, let's read Youngblood issue one. And they fucking did the voices through, as they described it. Reggie tweeted me today, through gritted teeth, because everyone talks of gritted teeth in the Image universe. it's hilarious. It's well worth listening to. Sort of get that in there. To be fair, we aren't copying you, although I did really enjoy your podcast, Chris and Reggie. It's we have been talking about this for a few months. It's just sort of purely coincidental that we picked the sort of reasonably same subject matter. Now, I suspect, because all we've done this week is send each other panels from ridiculous comics that we've been reading, that a number of other people might be doing Image books. Is that right? I'm going to take a guess.
Yeah, I'm doing
Related books, yeah. So what I thought, I was going to do an Image book. I was going to do Brigade issue 3, which is just awful. A fucking awful.
I got that issue too.
I knew you would, Matt.
I've got like 1 to 7 of Brigade, I think. And then
you're awful. Class. You are class, yeah. So I decided to go back and do. So I wrote a piece on this at Beard Rock, sadly, which is now folded. I wrote quite a long piece on this series, but it's Rock and Roll Comics.
Matt has deflated live on air.
I've shown you some of these, Matt. I think I bought them when I was with you, didn't I? When we went to
Did I buy you a couple of issues?
You did, that's right, you did.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
you bought the New Kids on the Block issue, which we'll talk about in a minute.
that's an episode by itself, I think.
That's a true friend, I think you'll find in the description, isn't it?
I bought you a Guns N' Roses one as well.
Oh, I've got that in front of me. That is class as well, yeah. Now, if you want to find the pinnacle of shameless, sort of superficial, badly thought out and atrociously put together shite, then you shouldn't go any further than Rock and Roll Comics. It is just fucking awful, and fuck you hipsters who think it's cool to own a copy. It ain't. They're rubbish. It was a series of pretty much unreadable comics that earned this company a number of spells in court defending themselves. It was published between 89 and 93, 65 issues. It was basically a long series of unauthorized, this is just the history of it, I'm going to get into a single issue in a second, but just to give you a little bit of a sort of scene set. It's basically a long series of unauthorized biographies of rock and pop bands and their characters. It's more famous for the covers, which were sort of vaguely passable, I suppose. Sort of a lot of airbrushed images. They look like they come off the side of vans in America, that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
The publisher and writer was Todd Loren, and he owned the company, which is called Revolutionary Comics, and he wrote nearly all the titles, and he wrote the stories in most of them. I guarantee you will have seen some of these covers to these. He's sort of sitting in dollar bins and stuff like that. But shrewdly, he did what he did. As a clever guy, what he did is he, during the time that was a big comic sales explosion, he made comics that sold easily in the big numbers in regards to comic fans, but also to music fans, if you see what I mean. So, covered such bands as Def Leppard, The Rolling Stones, Black Sabbath, Guns N' Roses, Frank Zappa, who sort of vaguely supported him. He didn't sue him, put it that way. And Zappa had quite a reputation for being quite litigious with stuff. Away from his sort of hippy-dippy image, Zappa was prone to take everyone to court. Metallica, Motley Crue, and he did a comic called Snotley Crue. That's hilarious. a comic on The Who. But his big enemies were New Kids on the Block, who he did a comic on. They don't really fit in that lineup, do they, to me? But,
no.
You know, New Kids on the Block. So they
Have
went
you
off.
Heard Hanging Tough?
Yeah.
They're rough.
Are you tough enough?
Loren also published a series called Carnal Comics that ran for many years. It's essentially erotica, sort of porn comics. I can't imagine. I've not read any of them. I don't like reading pornography. I can't imagine they're very, very good. But in 1992, Loren, at the age of 32, and still the publisher of Rock and Roll Comics that still was running, was murdered. And he got stabbed to death at his flat in San Diego, which is
where... New Kids on the Block?
Interestingly... They fans of New Kid on the Block are still, because it's unsolved still, this murder, and they are there. There is a number of conspiracy theorists who believe that fans of New Kids on the Block actually killed him. Yeah. I was reading an account by somebody who worked at Revolutionary Comics, and they actually said that the police interviewed, I think it was Sammy Hagar, Axl Rose, and New Kids on the Block, and they were asked to provide alibis. That's pretty cool, isn't it? How cool is it?
Yeah.
There's
when
a document
has forced New Kids on the Block collectively to provide alibis. You know you've made it.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. Now that's in an account from somebody who worked from the company. So it's probably some sort of conspiracy theorist. There was also a possibility that a spree killer, whose name I don't have in front of me, but there was a guy who was active in the area. I think he may have been a gay, killing gay guys because Todd was gay. I think there's some suspicion it might have been him as well, but never certain, never proved. There's a documentary on him, actually. It's called Unauthorized and Proud of It, which is sums up his working policies, to be fair. And in it are Alice Cooper. Now, Alice Cooper, I think, had a sort of strange litigious relationship with him as well. Dennis Kitchen from Kitchen Sink Press. And Gary Groth, if anyone knows who that is, from Fantagraphics and the Comics Journal. Gary, a man also not unfamiliar with sitting in the court and giving evidence, I think, from a number of the articles, certainly one he did with Harlan Ellison. where Harlan Ellison slagged off another creator's writing, and then they will end up in court. Now, at the time, there was a lot of sort of comics in relation to Rock Band. So you had the Grateful Dead comics, which I think was a fantastic, you know, Kitchen Sink, I think, were doing that. So Dennis Kitchen was responsible for that. Grateful Dead comics was actually pretty good, if anyone's read that. Todd got into deep water with them because he tried to bring out a Grateful Dead comic as well. Alice Cooper and Kiss at Marvel obviously had their own comics, which are quite well thought of, I think.
The Kiss ones especially, I hear a lot.
Sorry, mate?
The Kiss ones especially.
Yeah.
They have a lot of fans.
Yeah, they're the ones where they put their own blood in the ink, didn't they?
Ah, oh, we've all done that.
Yeah, yeah.
Did the Kiss comics go to Image? And because I remember Todd McFarlane making toys.
That's right, yeah.
When I was growing up, yeah.
They had their Psycho Circus as well, Todd McFarlane's Psycho Circus comics. They had a real sort of Capullo, Todd McFarlane style. I can't remember who did it now. But carry on, Todd.
I think I've got the trade of that for the first five. I've got the trade of that for the first five somewhere.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. Britain Madness.
The series was plagued, I mean, virtually every turn, but he ignored that, I think because the numbers were good. Issue 8, which was about the band Skid Row, was never released due to legal threats. But it was New Kids on the Block who really fucking hated him. And they took him to court, and he won the first one. He won the first trial against them. And then they countersued, and he set up a like an 0898 number at the time. I think they called them 900 numbers in the States, where you could ring up and donate £10 to the legal fees for the comic. And it was called Nuke the New Kids was the name of the call line. That's quite cool.
So what was so bad about these comics that these people wanted to go after him?
Well, I think they were just like very COD sort of autobiographical, which I'll get into in a minute, just fucking very badly done. But I think because of the time, there was a lot about, you know, taping music is killing music and all this sort of thing was going on at the time. And a lot around copyright laws and, you know, kids, you know, and I think sort of Pepsi Cola were getting people to pull videos from MTV and all that sort of thing. There was a lot about who had the right to publish stuff. It would have been hugely sad, you know, and this would have been this sort of big legendary story if the comics, I think, were probably any good, to be fair. But they were just fucking terrible. there's a really good article, which I took some information from. And if you surf about, you can find quite a lot about it. But www.rockandrollcomics, go there for the whole story. So I thought I'd pick one of their issues just at random and review it. So I picked issue number 5, which was the Def Leppard issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all love a bit of Def Leppard, don't we? Inside the cover, there's a big legal notification and a discussion and almost a big diatribe by Todd about some legal action that Motley Crue had taken on the previous issue against him. He's still sort of hugely defiant and railing against the system and the man and all this sort of thing, you know. The story, though, there's a number of stories in this. The first one's written by Todd, pencils by Larry Nadilski, inks letters by Johnny Childish, and it basically opens up on a sort of terribly drawn black and white page of the band playing. They're all different sizes, you know, all the people, they're none of their sizes compared to each other. And of course it has to have front and center, really obviously, the drummer Rick Allen, who is seated in a way that you can see that he's only drumming with one arm because he famously lost his arm, didn't he, in a car crash. Now the page 2. So basically, you set the scene with them playing like music on the first page. Music's never really translated great into comics, is it? You know,
no.
Apart from Mary Jane dancing around the front room, I've never really been convinced by music in a comic. But the second page is basically they came from Sheffield was the first panel, and the first panel is just this fucking terrible drawing of a factory, which that's to represent, you know, the whole of Sheffield.
pretty spot on then.
Then there's a sort of vague during it or throughout it. There's a sort of vague attempt to let characters tell their own story. You know, so one band member goes. He sort of goes on the wagon, and there's a picture of him sort of throwing a bottle of scotch away. You know, sort of representing it, and is him saying, "Our fans deserve our 100%. For me, that means the end of this." You know, it's just like this sort of rubbish sort of biographical attempt, you know. It's just on the notes constantly all the way through it. And then one of the other band members says to him, his perseverance is an inspiration to all other band members. You know, like, that's the sort of normal conversation that you have in a band.
I think that's fairly accurately represented.
And then there's a sort of page is all about how, you know, they're becoming too commercial and all this sort of thing. And there's a one picture of this sort of, they've this overly drawn, sleazily drawn agent who's holding a doll, which is the Rick Allen doll. And he's sort of cunningly showing that one of the arms can come on or off on this doll.
That's a sort of
representation of how commercial they were becoming, and they're upset about it, you know. Sort of totally over the top. At one point somebody says, oh, there's someone at the door. It's like a fucking terrible play that your mum was in when you were a kid or something, you know. And someone goes, oh, someone's at the door. And then there's a drawing of a door, and we just with the noise effect ding dong over the top of it. So not only is it like, we don't need to see that, that's a waste of time. Did they know that they were at the door before it had fucking rung? You know, it's just fucking awful. The second story is probably with art that I would have done when I was about five. No word of a lie. I hate to have a go at artists for their art, but this looks... I met up with Bob Fingerman earlier, and he said it looks like someone from high school has drawn that, and he is completely right. And it's basically this sort of completely insensitive story about how Rick Allen is in hospital, loses his arm, and it's actually a comic strip about the operation to sever his arm. And it's called Where There's a Will... And then it looks like a child's drawing. It definitely looks like a child. And at the end of it, there's sort of a nurse who's sort of looking from afar at him, so obviously in love with him as he wanders off into the sort of distance to play the drums. The third story is called Hysteria, written by Cy Dixon, art by Maxwell. Who the fuck that is, I don't know. Isn't he a singer, Maxwell? Inks and letters. Inks and letters by the pros from Dover. That's all they're willing to say about that. And the letters look like someone's drawing it in crayon. You can't really read it very well. But there's one moment here where this sort of really weird moment where he goes into a party, like it's like a backstage party, and there's a sort of vaguely badly drawn crowd scene. You know that scene in Napoleon Dynamite where the girl goes up to Napoleon and goes, what are you drawing, Napoleon? He goes, I'm drawing a liger. It's a cross between a lion and a tiger. Yeah. That's how I feel sometimes about the drawings in this book. You know, they just sort of make...
Let's not forget, Tony, that it was bred for its skills in magic.
It's like they're just two kids in the playground going, I'll bet there's a party. Who's going to be at the party? So in the party are these following people. Slash, who delivers the iconic line, I'm in the wrong comic. Nexus from First Comics. Beetlejuice. I mean, where the fuck... Who did this? Wolverine. Dr. Manhattan, a Cenobite. Honestly, I shit you not, all those people are sort of standing around, just sort of staring into the distance.
Did he not get sued for the Beetlejuice?
Just fucking bizarre. I'm going to show you this when I see you tomorrow, Matt. It's classic. Yeah. The fourth and fifth strips are kind of one-page sort of gag strips. One involves a bloke called Stan Back, who shoots a telephone after a record company call him, so there's no sort of hidden agenda in that strip. The fifth one, bizarrely, I actually quite liked. It's nothing to do with Def Leppard whatsoever, and it's called Siskull and Egbert, who are movie critics, satirically, by a guy called Ace Backwards. I don't know who he is. And it's about how they're critiquing the nuclear holocaust has just happened, and they're sort of complaining about it wasn't that realistic. Could have done with more backstory, that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And then the inside back cover is a rant. It's just a big, long rant of a text piece from Music in Action, this alleged sort of movement about companies controlling access to music, which is clearly just Todd writing as someone else. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because he's already ranted in the front of the comic about these people stole his ideas and stuff like that and all this sort of thing. So... Def Leppard, it's issue number 5 of Rock and Roll Comics. Don't buy it because it's so terrible. And it cost me £1, or I think actually Matt might have bought me it for £1. So there you go.
Yeah. Nice one.
Yeah, very strange.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fucking car crash.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was part of that when we used to do our contest of buying the worst comic we could find at a convention.
I think it might have been part of that, mightn't it? Yeah.
But I do remember, I think I might have bought it from Krypton Comics.
Yeah.
When we went into the back and it was like, I've won every competition going, so I'm going to take that. And no one can ever beat me ever again.
Yeah. We have to say, what we do is we have a we've done it on the show, haven't we, where we go and buy the worst possible comic we can find, and then we find someone to judge them. And I imagine this would win every time. It'd be an easy win, wouldn't it? You'd be cheating.
I think the last one I won, James Gibbs done the judging.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
you get the win.
Dean Beattie, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, Dean Beattie. Sorry, James Gibbs was in it as well with us lot.
That's right. Yeah.
I unfortunately won.
if you want to hear that, you can go to the London Super Comic Con special we did.
Yeah.
Way back in February last year. Bloody hell.
Yeah. So rock and roll comics, quite a thing.
Yeah.
Using comics, obviously, it's like dancing to architecture, isn't that the phrase Frank Zappa said? Makes no sense whatsoever.
But a man that does make a lot of sense, I'm looking forward to his pick this week, is Dan Butcher. So how do you follow rock and roll comics, Dan?
This is right up your street, dude, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's Youngblood by our good friend Rob Liefeld. Rob Liefeld annoys me. I've got to come back to him. Why? But I'm reviewing Youngblood issue 6.
Right.
Class.
Why
Youngblood 1, obviously.
Yeah.
There's a reason for 6.
Okay.
Youngblood 1, it came out like at the same time as all the other rest of the Image Comics 1 launched. You had Savage Dragon, Spawn, Cyberforce, Wetworks 1, and I think that kind of all the rest of them carried on. I think it took
Shadowhawk was the other one.
It took about 2 years to do the first Youngblood miniseries, which was 1-4, and it fucked up they fucked up the script, so they had to have the last bit of it, which was 5, on the back half of an issue of Brigade or something like that. So they plotted it so badly they had to have the remaining pages
and like, nobody noticed
in another comic. Yeah, and it doesn't impact the story whatsoever. You could have left it at 4 because it makes no sense. None of the stories in Youngblood makes it. It's like they're all standalone issues with same characters that don't translate on. Like what one says in one thing, it doesn't matter in the next issue because it's like they retcon every single issue. You don't need to know what's gone on before to pick one up because you won't know what's going on at the end of it. You're totally fucking mystified. So the reason I picked up issue 6, this was released shortly after the finale of 5, 2 years later. So kind of keeping up the hype. Rob Liefeld sat around for 2 years before kind of getting number 6 out of the miniseries. So now it goes into a continual series for some reason. And this time, like, they'd done Team Youngblood, which had, I think it had done like 8 or 12 issues of similar characters. So it's just, okay, fair enough, but not the main title. One of the things about Youngblood, especially this issue 6, introduces a raft of characters. And the previous introduced a raft of characters who've got no characters. They're no personality. They all look all the same. It's just so weird.
He does introduce a lot of characters, doesn't he, that you think are going to go somewhere. And then you think, oh, I don't know. What happened there? What was that about?
Yeah. I mean, we might cover it later on. But essentially, a lot of the Image output, especially from Liefeld, was just carbon copies of Image characters.
Yeah.
Just ripped off. And this issue 6 starts with a character who looks like, who is Cable, basically. And he's riding along on Kaneda's bike from Akira, sort of blasting the street. And the reason I picked 6 as well is because it's the only issue of Youngblood from the first ones that doesn't start with the Youngblood team in a jet ready to jump out and attack some base. Every issue starts the fucking same. They're all sitting around looking kind of angry, with shitloads of guns on their back, and then about 4 or 5 pages in, you get these big splash pages of them jumping out and attacking the base every fucking issue. And and you had that kind of collective kind of hypnosis where everyone was reading this, thinking this is the shit. But I just can't get past it.
Youngblood was one of the biggest sellers, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah, it was a huge seller.
Yeah,
absolutely huge seller. Yeah.
I remember right, I think it is the. I don't know if it was the first out of the whole Image line when they first come out. I don't know if Youngblood was the first.
I've got a feeling it might have been.
It might have been, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a great documentary called The Image Revolution. Have you seen it, Matt?
Yeah, it's good.
It's so good. I really want to see that, actually. I've heard a lot about that.
Yeah, and they basically, it talks a lot about how just money ruined them because they just got so rich, they just did what they fucking liked. I mean, Rob Liefeld built a spaceship in his studio, so they used to work out of the Youngblood spaceship.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's true. Like Spielberg was circling around some of his properties to make a movie.
Yeah, surprised at all. Yeah,
weren't there games, cartoons on the launch pad, and they all kind of just burned
trading
out really quickly.
Cards. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. There was definitely a cartoon by one of Rob Liefeld's creations, but I don't think it was Youngblood. I think it was, I can't remember what it was, but
Wildcats by Jim Lee, that had a cartoon.
I think there was another one as well that didn't really make it very far. I think it's got like a pilot episode online. I'll have to have
that. Okay. That's the problem with being in England. In America, all the Americans will be screaming at their phones because they got all this stuff, but we had to sort of fight to get a view of any of this stuff. Yeah. Even the action figures, which were such a big deal over there, we didn't see all of them, did we? No.
Rob Liefeld also has the original Conan the Barbarian sword, or he used to.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
I have actually met Rob Liefeld.
You have? I know.
I met him. And cut a long story short, sorry to interrupt that. That's fine. He's a really nice guy, really approachable, and he really appreciates people liking his work. And I'm not saying that I like his work, but the reason I read comics now is partly because of him.
A lot of people do, I think.
And he, believe it or not, when I was at the convention, the guy must have had 50 issues that I couldn't see what comic it was of him to sign the first issue of. So people, he's still got that massive fan bases.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You know? So.
I mean, I'd love to see his Killraven stuff. He's done a Killraven story, isn't he?
Yeah.
I'd love to see that published, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think his most recent work is like a Christian, because I think he's a churchgoer, so he's a Christian book.
He's got a graphic novel coming out, hasn't he?
Yeah, it might be the same thing.
Yeah.
And whenever you hear him on podcasts and stuff, he's the most positive and energetic person.
Yeah.
Going. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And like to have that. Let's face it, he's had quite a few years of people ripping his work and etc. to bits. So to keep that sort of energy going and to be like, wow, fuck it.
One of the problems I've got with it is the fact that he has bad habits in his art, and he doesn't seem to do anything to rectify it whatsoever.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, not just like a couple of years, it's like decades. This stuff's been pointed out to you and you've not bothered to work on it. I'm not sure if you sort of said, oh, fuck it, I'm doing what I'm doing, or
I'd read a comic by him. I liked Hawk and Dove that he did. You know, there's some, I didn't like his early stuff, but once in a while I'll read it and I'll enjoy it for what it is. But I think the problem was because they were making so much money back then in the day, and they were sort of kicking out comic after comic, he couldn't draw that many comics. So he basically got in people who were sort of pale imitations.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
I've got in front of me, I've got Troll Halloween Special Number 1. Yeah, which is probably about as good as you think it will be. And in it, the pencils are by Gabe Albarola, who is clearly just a poor Liefeld impression, you know?
Yeah.
And it's fucking poor. It's not worth reading, you know?
A lot of the image creators at the time, probably besides Eric Larson, I think they're all quite similar. So I think every single little below, so like Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld, Todd McFarlane, they look like they hired people who were lighter versions of them.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that was part of the problem. Maybe if they went a different route and employed people in different styles and different viewpoints, it might have been better.
You had about 4 years of them basically saying it ain't broke, so don't fix it. And basically just doing stuff that just repeated and churned out almost exactly the same storyline and very, very similar art on a sliding scale of quality. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, they seem to have... I haven't seen that Image documentary, but obviously they were artists and then they had to become businessmen.
Yeah.
And I don't know how successful that business part of it was. Because obviously it's a big difference between giving a script and drawing it, writing your own script, drawing it, and then running all the business side of it.
It's really, really worth watching because there is a split in the original seven. So I think three go the other way and then four go another. And I won't say why people want to watch it. I suggest they should, but you'll see people's intentions, where they lie and what they want to do and how much they love the craft and the art.
I mean, Rob himself has has been to has been and left Image at least twice over the years, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I was saying about the imitations, the kind of rip-offs. Is it Cyberforce?
Yeah.
The carbon copies of the X-Men as is.
Now watch yourself, dude. Right.
He loves Cyberforce.
When it came to Image, I mean, everyone had their sort of seat. I guess if you became an Image fan, there was always one title, wasn't there? It wasn't like you liked all of them. And even if you read all of them, I think there's always a case of like one title that you liked. For me, that was Cyberforce. That was the first one that I got into. And,
and it was the first time I really read...
Similar. They're both very similar sort of stories.
Very similar.
And it was my first sort of experience with Mark Silvestri's work. I love Mark.
Mm.
Yeah, Mark's work, brilliant. I think he's come a lot... Yeah, carry on, Matt.
Sorry, Dan. Sorry, Vince. Did you read... The Darkness, then? Was it The Darkness?
Yeah. Well, when The Darkness first came out, I was all over that. It was... It was awesome. Yeah. And just seeing, like, at the time, obviously, we've said it before, the 90s was when Wizard was quite big, and you see, like, the pencil pages, you know, they put that in the magazine, and just to see the pencil work was just amazing as well. So
Wizard was the hype train, wasn't it, at the time?
Oh, God, yeah. And I'd always be interested in reading those top 10 writers, top 10 artists lists and seeing how people moved up and down with whoever's trendy at the moment.
What was the one that got the TV series about the female...
Witchblade.
That was a strange one. Apparently that would have continued and actually was doing quite good numbers, but the actress was extremely unreliable, and that's politically... Me being careful about how I point it, but yeah, I think as I understand it, I think Jeff Loeb had something to do with that series.
Mm.
She became a very difficult person to rely upon. Put it that way.
Was that because she starred in Hard Target?
Was she in that as well?
Yeah, she's in Hard Target.
Yeah.
Quality film.
Great film.
Glad you brought that, Matt.
He jumps over a car. Unbelievable. Dan's paid his haircut on that.
Go on.
I was going to say some of the high points in Youngblood issue 6. There's the Cable character who's called Colonel Bravo. There's two pages in where essentially what he's wearing is different to what the page before it and the page preceding it is. And there's a shot of him turning around firing a pistol, and he's got like three backs. The anatomy is just unbelievable. I have to put it on the Facebook page because, it's amazing. Three backs. You kind of just don't expect to see it.
I was looking at the cover of Team Youngblood, and I think it's got that Cable ripoff on that one as well, dude. Is it Colonel Bravo? Is that his name?
That's it, yeah, Colonel Bravo.
Because he's Shaft's dad, isn't he?
Yeah,
I think so. I think that's how it works out.
Yeah,
which is Shaft, the leader of Youngblood, not the 70s detective. Yeah.
There's a part of this in where these kind of guys attack the White House, and the new Youngblood team have to attack more characters they don't flesh out, including the fan favourite troll. Shaft sort of jumps out of a second story window and says, "As for you, don't you think it's about time you crawled out of the Middle Ages? This isn't Camelot and you're not storming the castle, so welcome to Reality Buster." He's shooting a bow and arrow.
That's a hell of a line to say. I admire it. It's like Shakespeare, isn't it?
But the man's firing a bow and arrow at him.
Yeah. Well, funny you should mention
that. That's a bit rich, isn't it?
On the cover of Extreme Sacrifice Part 7 of 8 Team Youngblood, which is actually technically Part 6, so they misnumbered it on the cover. You've got let's call him Colonel Bravo, who's basically... Cable on steroids, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's got a gun they sort of redrawn it because it's on its side, but he's added another handle to it. But Shaft is the best part of this because his one arm looks like it's about to explode, literally. There's the muscle on the top of his arm, it just looks like it's about to explode. He's holding a bow that's clearly got no string on it, which is class.
They do, and even, call it a magnetic bow or something stupid like that.
Is that what it's called? Is that why it works like that? Okay.
I just need to know one fact, Tony. How many pouches does he have?
He's got a shitload.
On Colonel Bravo, I can see, I think, 12, but you can't see half of his body. So that's pretty good, isn't it?
I'll send a photo of that panel to you guys on the group.
Okay,
you can see that.
Yeah,
that works and on a podcast.
Wow. Yeah, I'll put it up on the Facebook page.
Okay. Oh, folks, I've just had a look at the picture, and yes, head on to the Facebook page because that dude needs to see a doctor. Seriously.
Yeah. Oh, which panel is that you put up, dude?
There's a panel of Major Bravo when he's kind of firing behind him, and he's got three backs. It's kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know how he's done it.
Three back Bravo. Yeah. That's what.
Yeah.
And his arm.
Yeah.
His arm.
I don't know. Looks like he's got two biceps.
Yeah. Yeah, like it looks like it doesn't connect.
But yeah, kind of like they mentioned the kind of the Liefeld and kind of not improving his art. The colouring and stuff in issue 6 and the inking's fine. But there's a bit where there's like a young lady in the audience firing got a handgun, and it just looks like that he's drawn two fists close together because he couldn't be bothered to look at the reference of one hand holding the other hand like in a gun. Holding a gun would. Kind of thought, oh, fuck it, fudged it. And it's just, at the time, I didn't see any of this, but upon like more recent reflection, it absolutely sticks out like a sore thumb. And I don't know, it irks me a little.
Did he get, obviously, because he did X-Force, do you reckon he not got worse, but he just ran out of time on trying to do stuff when he went to Image? And all these shortcuts that he thought were working didn't work?
Maybe. I mean, I will say this, like, when he was on X-Force and stuff, I was seriously into X-Force when it started. Mm. You know, I was all about it. Like, obviously, there was Cable and Domino and, you know, there was always... I mean, you look back on it now, and it's dated, but at the time, when I went into the newsagent and saw X-Force number one with one of the trading cards, which is, if you think about it, that is the perfect encapsulation of the 90s period.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There was like 10 copies. And I was in a small rural sort of town, and there was 10 copies in the local newsagent with a trading card. Do you know what I mean? It had no other comics, really. And then you had like 10 copies of X-Force. That says it all.
What did you think about the whole thing of Liefeld popping up in like Deadpool and basically kind of holding his hand up saying, yeah, Deadpool, that's on me? Because I feel like he had minimal amounts to do with that, really. I thought he only came up with the design, which is very kind of relatively generic. And
I mean, I've said this on the show before. I just thought he tried to draw Spider-Man and couldn't pull it off and turned it into a character.
Yeah.
He joked about like Deadpool's sort of mask being like the simplest way to do a Spider-Man mask. Do you know what I mean? Like he had to make a mask even simpler than Spider-Man, and he did
right.
And now that was one of the biggest films of the year. So,
no, a very good film.
Yeah.
I've just found that image that Dan was on about the Colonel on that Akira bike.
Yeah.
Online, I've just been searching.
Brilliant.
Yeah, Dan. Yeah.
It's like
I don't know. I can't describe it. Words don't describe how.
Yeah. He said, "I've taken everything with me I need," and it's just like a load of guns strapped to his back.
Well, they look like they're about to poke him in the back, like stabbed into his back.
The angles, so they're like going into his spine, which is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone goes on about sort of life or uses little tropes, you know, little phrases or things that, you know, and we all know about the pouches and the guns that are slightly weird shape. And we all know that everyone, you know, he does loads of characters who would appear to be very similar, let's say, to X-Men characters. But I found a couple of the story things he used. Like, I found three descriptions where he describes people or things as persons or groups as an ancient circle of near immortals. Everyone seems to be described as near immortals.
Yeah.
Well, fuck me, they're either, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're either one or the other.
Yeah.
So this issue of Youngblood, obviously the focus has been on Mr. Liefeld, but did he write this as well?
He's credited as being the creator, pencils and story. And a gentleman called Eric Stevenson is the script and the editor.
Eric Stevenson
now is the editor-in-chief of Image, isn't he?
Well, he's gone. He's done well.
Yes, he has.
Well done, Eric.
So there's one line in it that really bugs me, and this is a really small point. But Sharp's been introduced to these new characters, and one of them's a new diehard. And he says, wait a second diehard. So like you've got second in the same thing. Like, why wasn't that picked up? It's really... Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, he's a bit of a sort of writing nerd. He puts fucking apostrophes everywhere.
Yeah.
And that winds me up a treat.
Because once you start getting into the writing, and I try my best, but like just little things like that, it's like I pore over what I'm writing, trying to get it right and sound it out a couple of times. Yeah. And when you just see like that, it just seems like, oh, well, let's write a young blood comic. And then you just kind of seems to be made up as it goes along.
Yeah.
Have no real
It is the equivalent of people in the school playground with a load of action men going, right, now my one's got a fucking sword and he's from Germany and he's going to fight yours. And then you got, you know, all of like Rob Liefeld's mates at Extreme Studio saying, yeah, what if he's not German? What if he's from Mars? Yeah, he's from Mars. It's almost like they're making it up on the fly. Yeah. I'm just reading Team Youngblood has got because it's part of this sort of cross-team thing, it's got like little bios of the characters. And there was a team called the New Men. Do you know who that is?
Yeah.
New Men with no space between them. That's all one word. That makes no fucking sense. And it says, an unwitting team of new gene positive teenagers. Seriously, Rob, did you go there? Did you call them new gene positive? I mean, seriously? All these people, especially at this time, you know, not surviving being HIV positive, but good old Team Extreme decide new gene positive was completely fine. Completely fine to say that.
What's the one that he advertised? He bought an advertising strip in one of the comic, I think, and it was The Executioners, and he nearly got sued by Marvel when he was actually at Marvel. Yeah, because they said it was too like the X-Force.
Yeah. Yeah,
if you can look that, I think it was called The Executioners, and he never got a chance to make it.
I mean, I had an interview with him yesterday. I was listening to in preparation of the show, and he openly said, "Look, I just took the X off things." You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
He cunningly changes that for Youngblood, and he takes one of the X's and makes it a Y. So there's a black Y on a red background.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know where he comes up with these ideas. It's amazing. Yeah.
Has anyone got any personal favourite characters that they've read? I know we swapped a few in the week, didn't we?
What, from Youngblood or...?
Or from any of these Image comics, you know. I picked up a couple. There was Silence, with a P, P-S-I, Lens, who's a young telepath who, get this, is mute. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who thought, then what happened first? You get a name first? There's Soul, S-E-O-U-L, spelt like the city. That's right. Cool. Wonder where she was cool. from. Rubble, who's basically the thing. But they called him Rubble.
There's one, I think he was called Brahma or something.
Right.
And he, this the big massive dude with like a flat top, and he had a bee on his chest and like red and white spandex. And it was like, so what's this guy's thing? Nothing, this is strong. Okay.
There was a character called Backlash, whose real name was Mike Slayton. That's cool, isn't it?
Backlash had quite a cool series, actually. get this,
he's virtually immortal. Fuck off.
Of course he is.
Yeah. And then they created the young blood team, didn't they? They were like the youngsters who were coming up, a bit like the New Mutants were, and he called them Bloodpool. Who the fuck calls a team of teenagers Bloodpool? It's a slightly strange name for an underage version of Youngblood, I've written here in my notes. There you go.
I tell you one thing. I mean, Rob Liefeld's corner of the Image Universe. This is coming in the Rob Liefeld show, isn't it? Will even more in a minute. That studio that he had, they churned out books. Whereas you had the others, you had like, I don't know, Top Cow. They had like Cyberforce, and then eventually they had Strikeforce, and then there was Witchblade.
Yeah, Shadowhawk took ages to come out as well, I remember.
Yeah, and even like Jim Lee's lot, they didn't have too many, but the Rob Liefeld corner was just churning out different books. You'd have a series based on Bad Rock, which was one of his most popular characters. You know, but the thing that always stuck out to me was how many people in that universe had Wolverine's hair.
They wore a flat top. They'd love the both of them, didn't they?
And let's be honest, Logan's hair is A, shit. No matter how, like, there is no way his mask is that shape just to fit over his hair. and B, it's clearly, as soon as you do that hair, you know exactly what that's a copy of. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, can't get away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who is the character that was basically Psylocke, but basically drawn exactly like Psylocke.
Psyblade.
Yeah.
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 She looked exactly the same, and she had a blade, and she was psychic.
She had the same blade. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, would you recommend Youngblood number 6, Dan?
I don't know. That's a hard one. I don't know. I think it's a curious read. Any of them, a Youngblood comic, if you check them out. I mean, Rob's images are often kind of like pulled out and said, "Oh, look at the way comics treat women." And there's a picture of a Rob Liefeld image. So I don't take anything serious from a Youngblood comic.
No, you know what you're getting as well. You really do, don't you? Mm. You know,
it's just. It's one of those, when people say Rob Liefeld now, it's kind of like a lot of people just roll their eyes back. But like Matt said, he got me into comics big time.
Yeah.
And although kind of like now I take the piss and laugh at it, he did kind of like get me into it big time, all the Image crew.
I wonder if comics would still be going if it wasn't for that crew.
Yeah.
Because of the big sales bump they gave everything, you know, and people still look back on it now.
They kind of burnt... I felt burnt out from that. I kind of stepped back from comics for quite a while after that because I felt like I'd been kind of hoodwinked a little, and I kind of stepped back and I was more kind of into the comic art as opposed to
you do hear that
reading
a lot,
it so much.
Yeah, mm. Yeah.
The stories were a lot emptier as well, I find, a lot of the time.
There was no personal stories.
You talk about a lot of the great art or, you know, the terrible art or whatever, but how many times can you say this storyline stayed with me? You know what I mean? You can't immediately name it.
That little corner of the comics world was about visuals, wasn't it? There's no doubt about it. It was about cool looking designs and visuals. It wasn't about, you know, none of the dialogue worked. Very few of the storylines actually fucking made sense. You know,
Sorry,
Dan. Mark Naiman, because he taught me at university, Mark. We had a chat about this years and years ago, and I go, "What did I read?" And he goes, "Because of the visuals, and you're a teenager, and it appealed to you. It's kind of like a teenager's way of reading stuff that they shouldn't be, really, in a way." And some of the stuff that I'll bring up later.
I mean, I feel like a very kind of anti way with rebels going against the big two. And this is new, brand new and fresh.
And there's also an uncomplicated story where we'd reached a point where the X-Men universe had begun to get quite. You know, it's worse now, but had begun to get quite convoluted, and there were sort of spin-off and mini stories, and a lot of crossovers had started. You know, had Secret Wars and all that sort of thing, and so on. Secret Wars
but
too.
It was because of the success of like the X-Men comics. Marvel was very much an X-Men universe. Well, I mean, I was reading a lot of those books, so I wasn't so much aware of like the other characters in the Marvel universe because X-Men was just so prevalent and everywhere.
I'm not sure if the Image kind of documentary covers this, but I always saw Marvel looked at how Image were doing, how well they were doing, and they had a kind of knee-jerk reaction of trying to make their characters edgier and
very much so. Kind of you've only got to look at Heroes Reborn, haven't you? You know, where they basically rehired probably huge amounts of money a lot of the guys who'd left to go to Image to recreate their comics. So you had which I think we're going to talk about in a minute, aren't we?
Which brings me quite nicely to my pick.
Nice one.
That was good.
Yeah, there you go. And thanks for the segue, Tony.
Thank you.
I had to... Obviously, Heroes Reborn, as Tony was saying. Like, after the boom of Image, Marvel decided... I mean, where were these characters at the time, Tony? It was Fantastic Four, Captain America...
Iron Man,
Hulk.
And Avengers, I think.
Yeah. They were... basically anyone who wasn't the X-Men, really, wasn't it? Most of it.
Yeah, I think the X-Men were off limits for some reason, weren't they, I think?
Yeah. And because these characters were kind of treading water, or maybe the sales weren't that great, Marvel decided to bring in some of the Image big names. I think it was Will Sportasio came back, Rob Liefeld, Jim Lee. Were there any others, or was it just that main team?
I can't remember off the top of my head now.
Yeah, I know Will Sportasio.
Was Mark Silvestri? Mark Silvestri didn't come back, did he?
No, he didn't.
I think Top Cow were kind of off on their own at that time, weren't they?
So each of them were. We're creating the main Marvel heroes that we all know and love now from the, you know, the cinematic universe and beyond, but this was way before then when no one really cared about them so much. Let's be honest, it was at that point. Things like the Fantastic Four were could you probably say they were kind of dead in the water, or they were treading water. So Marvel were desperate to inject new life into it. So on paper, I remember there was massive build up to this. You just think, oh, Jim Lee's coming back, and Jim Lee's doing the Fantastic Four. My God, you know, this is big stuff.
What was the story in universe? Did they all disappear?
They went to a pocket universe, didn't they? Played with a bit since.
Yeah, it was during the Onslaught saga. All of the heroes that got reborn, as it were, sacrificed their life. Sorry for spoilers, but you should have read this by now. That story's probably dated.
20-odd years old.
Yeah. they gave their life fighting this huge creature, Onslaught, and disappeared. And a couple of months later, these comics appeared. So it was a universe reborn.
And then a couple of months later, they stopped appearing.
they stopped appearing. They probably had about 6 or 7 issues each, and then it all went back to how it was.
Everyone fucking got into arguments, and it all stopped again. Yeah.
So the one I wanted to talk about, which was my pick, was Captain America number 1 from 1996.
Yeah.
Which happened to be another Rob Liefeld comic. Yeah. So did he
write them?
I'm about to give you the.
Oh, sorry, my bad.
Because this one, it's easy enough. A lot of people have said stuff about this, and it's easy enough to point the finger at Rob Liefeld, you know, for his artwork or whatever. No matter how much you defend, you know, even if you're a big fan of Rob Liefeld, you can hardly say that this was his high point. But he is not alone in what he did on this. This is no word of a lie. That what I'm about to read to you is how that they've credited the creators on it. So it's Rockin' Rob Liefeld on art, and none of these words have a G at the end. So it's just Rockin'.
It's cooler that way.
Yeah, it is cooler.
Very
90s. There's Jazzin' Jeff Loeb as the writer.
Oh my God.
You've got Jovial John Sibal, who's the inker. I've probably said that wrong. You've got Bombastic Brian Haberlin, who's colours. Extreme Colour did the separations. There's no funny name for that. Righteous Richard Starkings with Comicraft and Comicraft's Dave Lampfear on the letters, and Bouncing Bob Harris as the editor. Why do you think that that's a... I mean, I don't understand why they've done that.
I don't know.
I'm speechless.
I'm speechless.
This issue does render you speechless. And what can I say that hasn't already been said? But this isn't a high point for the Steve Rogers mythos. Should we just say that? And it just has to be seen to be believed. I mean, I picked it up when we're talking about 90s comics. I don't have loads of long boxes full of old dusty comics. They're not easy to hand. So, and I was trying to think, you know, what are these major titles that deserve to be spoken about? And I think because it's been so long now, this came out in 1996, so this is, oh my God, this is 21 years old?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I now feel ancient.
21 years old?
Yeah.
21. Wow. Yeah.
There could be people listening to this show that haven't got a fucking clue about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you like Marvel Comics, find out about the Heroes Reborn stuff. We won't necessarily recommend it, but I think it's worth exploring what happened during then, because it's quite an interesting sort of experiment. Because it was an experiment, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You can say that.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember buying that not maybe about 5-10 years ago. Like, I saw it for 99p, and I didn't want to buy it at the time because I was on my Cap Wolf hiatus.
What the Cat Wolf hiatus, where you've had Cat Wolf and life doesn't possibly get any better.
So. No, I snapped.
Yeah.
Tank snapped. And I was like, I can't do it. I can't do it anymore. So, I give it a go because I missed that, and it's just absolute garbage, that whole comic.
I would say that front to back, and there's about 42, 44 pages in this. This is just a bad comic. And I hate. I'm a Captain America fan. I will say that I haven't read too much of him outside some of the bigger sort of runs, and I probably read more of his stuff now than I did certainly back then. But in terms of just story structure and artwork, just the whole package, nothing works in this book. It starts off like Steve Rogers. He's living a sort of normal life. He's married to Peggy, has a son. but he keeps having nightmares about like Captain America fighting in the war, and like he's questioning his very sort of life, you know, his normal life and what's happening. It is a comic that literally states everything that happens. Like he has a nightmare, which I've got to say, the first page that you start on in this comic is one of the most unbelievable experiments in comic art I've ever seen in my life. There's whether it's, I don't know, huge things in the foreground, the perspective is weird. There's Captain America standing on top of a mountain looking over a battlefield, and he is actually bigger than a tank, which is in the foreground. You could say it's a dream sequence, but come on, let's be fucking serious here.
One of the things that really bugged me about that is that they changed the A on his head.
Yes.
And they put like a little eagle there for what reason?
So
if you're going to go for a costume redesign,
that is the laziest costume redesign in the world, isn't it? Really. On this first page as well, there's like a Nazi soldier like in the foreground, just getting absolutely blasted by a soldier holding what looks like a toaster. He's firing something. it's like Dan said before. There's no the hand placement of the gun. The helmet that the soldier's wearing looks more like a beanie hat. It's fabulous art on this first page. It gave me everything I wanted and more.
I said one of the things, the beauty is if you're having a comic set in World War One or Two, is there's such a rich kind of like the visuals you can draw.
Yeah.
And I can remember that there's no the German uniforms of this kind of like, I think they look like something like this.
There's no detail on them. Medieval soldiers from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah.
Their helmets, like there's no thought to detail, and like, you know, there's certainly no reference.
No.
And certainly no backgrounds.
It's just rubbish.
Yeah. So I mean, the art's an easy go-to, but I've got to say that the story itself is. You know, let's put Liefeld's art to the side for a moment and look at the story. And the writing and the pacing is like something out of a cheesy sort of early 90s science fiction show. You know, one of the really bad ones without a budget, like that Conan the Barbarian series. or the Time Cop series. Do you remember the Time Cop series?
Yeah.
No, there was a Time Cop series.
Oh, Matt, you've got...
Oh, I've not been born. I had no idea there was a Time Cop series.
You should.
Sorry.
Check that out. Once we finished, you should check that out.
Yeah.
Now Jeff Loeb, he's written some classic stuff, hasn't he? And I mean, when it comes to reading his stuff, I blow a bit hot and cold on some of it. I mean, I'm not a big fan of his the third Ultimate series that he did. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, that was.
Yeah.
I really liked it. And then, like, the third one, it starts off with all of them sitting around a room watching a pornographic film two of their friends are in. And we've all done that.
We've all done that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Thor in that series, for some reason, talks like, you know, that sort of Shakespearean dialogue, whereas he didn't before in the two series before that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird.
But for some reason, there's a kind of thing with the Maximov twins.
Yeah,
they sort of alluded their relationship was a bit off. Yeah. And then in that one, this is that they're having sex together, sleeping together.
I mean, that series for me was more about the Madariya art.
Yeah, he's fucking awesome in that.
Yeah, awesome. Whereas the story wasn't much, and whereas this, the story isn't that much, and the art doesn't help it either.
No.
And like, Loeb's doing some amazing stuff on the TV side of Marvel with the animated and, like, you know, what we're seeing. He has his hand in a lot of different production sort of stuff, doesn't he? But this particularly is probably not one of his highlights.
Definitely, yeah.
And the style of the story doesn't really suit Cap either, I would say.
Does it basically, he comes back and he's been brainwashed or something, he can't remember that he's Cap,
and then, like, some bad guys attack him, and then he gets caught in an explosion, and just wakes up and all of a sudden he's Captain America again. After some mysterious guy from his past, like, gives him a shield, which is way too small, and then Cap's got it on his arm, and then it's way too big. And then
this changes all the time.
And then he's got it on the wrong place on his arm. There's one panel where he switches where the shield is. Like, he's holding it on his left arm through most of it, and one panel he's got it on his right. He doesn't... He hits one bad guy with the shield, like a sort of backhander, and it's like a sword. It's like the bad guy's just been cut by it. There's blood going everywhere. I was reading it thinking, what's going on? I don't understand. It's like you're having some sort of fever dream.
Because there's that one image in that when he's kind of like caps side on, and it pops up everywhere where he's like his chest.
Yeah, is this the quite famous one where he's,
that one.
Which Liefeld has, he's got quite good humour about it, I think.
Yeah,
you know, he has sort of owned up to that. And there's people.
I say, did you guys ever read any of the other titles? Because I didn't at the time.
I picked up the Fantastic Four at the time, mainly for like the Jim Lee art and stuff. And that was another one where I think it was style over substance, if you ask me.
Yeah.
And the Iron Man, the Wills Portacio art, it was another one where I like Wills Portacio's like wet work stuff, and I remember when he was on the Punisher for a long time. That was awesome when he did the Punisher. I mean, yes, everyone had like their face was nothing but muscle, but it worked for that. But with his Iron Man one, I mean, technically there was lots going on, but there was also a weird sort of Hulk, wasn't there? If I remember correctly, it had like long hair and it was more bestial. Yeah, there was a lot of it.
Yeah, that rings a bell. I remember vaguely the Iron Man one.
Yeah.
But as a kid looking at the design of it, I was like, as you said, style over substance.
Yeah.
I was like, it engaged me straight away, and then obviously reading it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the Fantastic Four one did the best out of all of them, I think, because I think that one might have been a little more coherent in terms of what it was and the retelling of the story and things like that. And obviously Jim Lee was kind of on fire at that time.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if I was doing one of those titles and you got offered up Cap, you would go fucking nuts out, like really, I'm going to really show him on this. But in that, I can remember just being more lazy than
lazy's the perfect way to describe it, and I hate sort of having, you know, I hate saying that about comics, but like in terms of, and I'm no stranger to not putting a background on something, but literally there's hardly any backgrounds to all of this, or it's almost like copied and pasted sort of like audience backgrounds, perspectives weird, there's a bunch of nuclear missiles at one point that look like he's just drawn a picture of some crayons in close up. People are like, they're deeply in shadow. You know, if you can't be bothered to draw the rest of the face, you're just going to have them in shadow, even though the lighting doesn't work.
Does the red mask pop up in there? I can't remember.
The red mask doesn't, because that's my character, Dan. I would have sued Marvel if he popped up in there.
Sorry, the red skull.
The red skull. the red skull doesn't. I think he's alluded to. But there is, I've got it in front of me now. I need to, what's the name of the character that
I think Baron Zemo comes up.
He's not in this one, but Master Man is the bad guy in issue one. who's like, you know, he's bad because he's sat next to a Nazi symbol in like an old chair, and his body is like 1 foot tall, and his legs are about 6. That's how you can tell villains.
That's why he's a master.
he's a master of a man, and he also has so many lines on his face. It's unbelievable. He's got cable face, some would say. Yeah. He's got so many lines that when you put his face in shadow, the lines on his face you can still see. Yeah.
Good.
There's so many.
This will tie into Matt's one, but all the bad guys in most of the Image comics were dudes sitting in big offices at the top of high-rise tower blocks.
Yeah.
Plotting evil schemes.
So quite realistic then, to be fair.
Yeah.
a bit ahead of its time, let's face it.
Yeah. You mean, you have, like, everything is very basic in this. Like, the houses are very basic. He loves rubble, as you can tell, because he created the character called it. But, I don't know, it's just, you can tell, it's almost like he created a comic to do 3 splash pages, and then someone else had to write the comic around it. That makes sense. But even on one of the splash pages, when you finally see Steve Rogers revealed as Captain America, that's one of the unfortunate ones where the shield placement is a bit weird, and the shield's quite small, and his hand is sticking out from underneath the shield. I remember I sent that issue.
You sent this to once.
because it just the scale of the shield just changes throughout it. It's worth seeing. The bad guys, I don't know what's going on with their design. It's although there are some, there's a street gang in it that you can tell they're bad because they've got tattoos of a red skull on them. Ooh. Yeah, they're bad, aren't they? But I mean, so much I can say about it. I do actually. I got it for £1.49 digital, and I will say this: I recommend it. I do actually recommend it, and I'll tell you for why. You should go. Just to it's a very useful learning tool. You know, treat it as that. Look at it. You're not going to read that good a story, but there's so many mistakes, whether it be in the writing or the artwork. You know, that people just need to, or design of characters. I think the design of characters is just weird in this, so I do recommend it.
The overall thing kind of from a lot of this I take is, like, if someone tries really hard and it doesn't work, that's fine, but when it's kind of just feels like it's been dialed in and you don't give a shit, it really kind of it gets my back up. It really annoys me.
I think that's what surprised
I've only found this out. They paid it.
Yeah.
Oh, you fucked me over.
And that's what really surprised me. You know, you've got these massive characters. They were Marvel sort of tentpole characters, in a sense. You know, they were the historic ones. And you would have thought that, you know, all of the number ones would have been like, holy shit, I'm seeing something special here.
Exactly.
So to see this sort of issue one just be so almost basic, and like the story's like, it doesn't, it's like from another time. And I know some stories, they work having that sort of retro feel. But mixed with the tech and the action that's going on, nothing gels. Nothing really gels. And there, I will say, there's one page where I think one of the last pages, actually, the last pages of this comic, three of them, I think, in a row are splash pages, which is a how often do you finish a comic with three splash pages in a row? One of them is a cool picture of Nick Fury. You know, it's the Nick Fury reveal. And I looked down and I thought, that's pretty cool. You know, you can tell that Rob Liefeld has enjoyed drawing this, and there's a lot of work in it. It looks nice. And this isn't his fault, but then he's putting his hand down on a mirrored table in front of him. And the reflection is just, someone's just flipped the artwork after it's been coloured. And none of it matches up. So it renders a page, which otherwise would look, you're there going, this is great, this is great. Oh, this is awful. Do you know what I mean?
Which is such a shame, bearing in mind that Rob actually inks while he's driving.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
He is a crazy man.
Yeah. If you look that up on YouTube, see how many dislikes that video's got. There's a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the best video ever. I think he's obviously he was a bit behind on his pages, wasn't he? And he said, oh, look at me, DC Comics. I'm inking Hawk and Dove while I'm driving at like 5 to 6 in the morning or something. I thought that was class.
Yeah, if you did that now, that's just basically, you'd get sacked immediately.
Yeah, you've got to love the boy from the geezer, though, haven't you? You don't care, Z. No. You've got to love it about him, haven't you?
Captain America 1, you've got to
probably get someone writing into the show saying Tony likes Rob Liefeld's balls. Well, I do. I love them, each and every one of them.
And there's nothing wrong with liking balls.
Yeah, thank you.
Anyone who wants to take that bit of audio, put it on a loop, or maybe mix it into a tune, we heartily recommend it.
If you like good comics, that's all I'm going to say. If you like good comics, then you like Rob Liefeld's balls. That's all I'll say.
Oh dear.
Speaking of balls.
Yeah. Speaking of balls, though, that's me. I mean, literally, I could talk about this a lot, but. Rob's not paying us any money, so I don't think we should talk about it anymore.
No. I reckon it's worth getting, and then get that, because I had a bit of technical problems there, I missed a bit. Have you mentioned Fighting American yet?
No, we have not.
No.
Tell the listeners a little bit about Fighting American and the story.
Fighting American is a character that's appeared on and off through the comics over the years. I think it's a Golden Age character, wartime sort of version of Captain America, I think whatever Marvel would call back then, they created him as well. I believe he's owned by someone else. I'm going to say Joe Simon. I'm not 100% sure. But basically, when Rob either sacked or left, I'm not sure what happened, the Marvel gig, he basically turned a lot of the pages, allegedly turned a lot of the pages into Fighting American issue 1 and 2. I think it only ran a couple of issues.
Yeah.
So all the stuff that he'd drawn for Captain America, it got a little bit of a reworking. I'm going to say probably not a great deal of a reworking, and then became Fighting American issues 1 and 2.
Yeah,
that's unbelievable.
Which he put out under Awesome Comics, I think. Believe it or not, he stole that from us. 10 years before we invented it. Yeah. But he put out Awesome Comics, and that was Fighting American was just basically Captain America. It's another Captain America. But then again, it always was from the start, I suppose.
Yeah.
Didn't Alan Moore write some of the Awesome stuff?
He did, yeah. He wrote the Supreme.
A very sort of well-thought-of run of Supreme, wasn't it? He was essentially a Superman knockoff, but...
Yeah.
I think it's like anything. If you get the basis of a character or a seed of something you can do with it, you know, don't necessarily be put off by a character, you know.
No.
Like Prophet or Glory.
Prophet's horrible. Yeah. I mean, Prophet is a comic series. I was looking at he appears in Team Youngblood in one of the issues. I think
he's just shit.
Horrible sort of Gambit style character, Shatterstar or whatever those characters were, you know.
Yeah.
And then, but then they turned it into something like really interesting, really sort of new wave sci-fi type stuff, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, for instance, the Glory series, you know, Gone was the sort of Wonder Woman kind of rip-off, and it became this really strange action sci-fi where she was like a really sort of hugely mutated sort of female warrior, wasn't she, or something like that?
Yeah, bought for me on my birthday this year by Mr. Harrower.
Yeah, well,
trade paperback.
Yeah, it's a good book.
You're
fond of that
comic
series, weren't you?
Yeah. Mm. So there you go. I mean, you know, we could have a chuckle about some of these characters, but there are people out there like those great writers and creators who can just sort of say, right, I can take the gem of this, and let's do something with it. And that,
which they've done with all characters all over. I mean, they did it with Batman. Batman had guns in the foot, you know, and they've done it. Yeah. With Superman, it was fairly fucking one dimensional. Let's face it, wasn't he, when he started? You know.
Yeah. That's the beauty of comics, though, isn't it? You can do so much with it. All the
time. That's what the problem was with that Cap issue, that you've been given an opportunity to your spin on this, and you just half-assed
it. Just wasted. But you know, I mean, I don't know the behind the scenes. You know, like,
and you've got to remember that Rob was, I mean, he was very, very young when he took. You know, he didn't go to art school. He just took his folder along, showed it to Marvel people, and they hired him on the spot. Mm. And he was very young. He was very headstrong, as we all are at that age. You know, and we all think our shit doesn't stink, and we're going to rule the world. And he kind of fucking did, really, didn't he? Let's face it.
I wonder if those Captain America pages turned up in the office, and if there was quibbles with him, it's like, well, we got to suck it up.
Yeah, this
is what we got to do.
Yeah. He sells millions of comics.
And also, at that time, Marvel were not a strong presence.
They'd hit bankruptcy.
That was
the
bankruptcy
time,
wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, it's interesting times, but Captain America number one, definitely look it up on your travels if you haven't discovered it before. But, Matt...
Can we just take a quick break so I can read out an advert I found for an Image product here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, here's an ad break.
Yeah, I found a copy of Previews, which, because I'm a weird hoarder who's going to die one day and be eaten by cats, I found a copy of Previews from June 1997.
How does it smell?
It smells a little bit musty, but then a lot of my stuff does. And it's the Wildstorm Lingerie Collector's Pack. Yes.
Lovely.
The Wildstorm, you can buy a whole pack of trading cards. This is the description they give it. Wildstorm Lingerie Collector's Pack of trading cards. This is the moment you've been waiting for! Exclamation mark. Yep, we clearly all had been. I've been waiting to whack it to trading cards for a long time. The wonderful women of Wildstorm dare to be, brackets, almost, close brackets, bare, in a sensual display of lingerie. The Wildstorm Lingerie Collector's Pack features 50 trading cards packed in special tuck box. I don't know what that means. And sold as a complete set. Get them while they're, !! hot, !! It's not exactly Shakespeare, but there you go. I'm sure they sold quite well, didn't they?
I tell you what, though. What's the point of... a lot of trading card people are going to be like, what are you talking about? What's the point of just buying a complete set of trading cards just in one go?
Because they're in their lingerie, and they're almost, close brackets, bare.
Yeah, and bear with me, here's a business idea. Do them as individual packs. So then, like, you know, young lads, you know, where's the next... wank coming from? Do you know what I mean? They've got a chase for it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, DVA. Let's go to DVA. All about Gen 13. Look at the tits on that. It's like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, this of course this is the decade of the swimsuit special. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Oh. I just found that
a photo of it. I've got a photo on the Facebook group.
Oh yeah, you did, didn't you? Yeah.
Some light reading before bed.
I thought it was a little opportunity to read that out. I thought that was a nice little ad break for us. Yeah. It's your face in that picture makes me laugh. That's why it's so
it. It's not the first time he says that. Right, back to the issues we're going to look at. And Matt, have you got issues?
Yeah, got plenty, but yeah. I'm training off the Rob Liefeld route. Just leave him alone because he was nice
bleeding in the gutter.
God bless you,
Rob Liefeld.
Please come on the show, please.
I've gone the Spawn route, but with the two spin-offs that they did. So one was The Curse of Spawn in issues 5, 6, 7, and 8, and then Spawn the Impaler, which was a three-part mini issue. I don't know where to start. I'll start with Spawn the Impaler. Spawn the Impaler is an updated version, in a way, of Spawn, but Spawn was actually Vlad the Impaler, and he's come back after the original Spawn that we get in the original comics. And it's written, believe it or not, by story and pencils by Mike Grell.
Oh, bloody hell.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Yeah, and then
I've got a picture of me and Grell in front of me on the wall.
Yeah,
I love that guy.
You wouldn't think it's him.
Oh, right, okay.
They said story and pencils, Mike Grell, artist, if I remember right, Rob Pryor, but it looks like a B. That's how bad the type is in this issue. Okay. I think it's Pryor. I did a bit of research, and it is the same guy, so I think it's Pryor.
Right.
And how best to describe the artwork is atrocious. I read through it first this morning to catch back up on it, and I couldn't read all of it. I really couldn't make my way all the way through it. And then I found out it was Mike Grell had something to do with it, and I was like,
whoa. You know I love him as well, because I made a picture of him with me.
Yeah.
Mike Grell did. He did Sable for First Comics. He did a big run on Green Arrow. He did Green Arrow, the Longbow Hunters.
But what he did Shaman's Tears.
Exactly. Image? Yeah, he did Shaman's Tears for Image, which was a big seller. Which is a lot. It was quite a decompressed storytelling, I'm going to say that. Mm. But yeah, I think he must have finished Shaman's Tears by this point and gone on to Spawn the Impaler. he just sobbed into his own lap crying. Yeah. But he's brilliant. I absolutely love his stuff, Mike Grell. But yeah, it's a shame. There you go.
Yeah, it's like a photorealistic painterly style, isn't it?
Right.
And I can't describe it. It starts off by the looks of it, World War One. I can't really tell by the storytelling. A lady dies, and then Vlad the Spawn, Hellspawn, arises again.
Right.
Kills everyone on the battlefield. Yadi da di da. And then it goes into a Blade Runner-esque sort of world. And then like words don't describe again. It's just, I can't believe they published it, to be honest with you. Like, I'm looking at four panels now, and I wish I could show you really well. Like, I don't know. Like, there's not very many backgrounds. A lot of it's purple. It's really
is that important? Do you not like purple?
No, I just don't know why there's so much purple backgrounds.
Maybe Prince involvement with the colouring.
Was it sponsored by Ribena? Yeah.
Sponsored by Ribena. Just found it.
That's the natural sponsor of Spawn,
Ribena. Yeah, Ribena. Apple Ribena, because it used to bleed green. So he rises back up from rises back into like this Blade Runner-esque sort of world, and becomes the Hellspawn of that time. And then he sees a reincarnated version of his wife, and it's just a story of him trying to get back with his wife while killing loads of people. But there is a twist at the end, which I don't want to ruin for people. there is a twist at the end of the three issue run.
So hang on. You're saying you can't believe it was made. It was atrocious, but you're recommending it?
No.
Let's spoil it. No, come on, let's spoil it. Okay, spoilers. Spoiler. No one cares. Yeah.
So it goes back in time as well. As you can tell so far, I had trouble reading it. So as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, like not just image books, but depending on the artist, it's really hard for the storytelling. It's not very clear. Because I'm dyslexic. So at that age, I think it was 97 that was released. So I just started secondary school. So
right,
my dyslexia was really bad at the time, and I wasn't really getting much help. So I went to secondary school. So I read comics as in pictures, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course.
So I couldn't read a lot of the words at the time. And looking back at it now, obviously, touch wood, I can read a little bit better, but trying to read it in pictures is an absolute nightmare. I don't know where it goes. I don't know what's going on. There's no sequential storytelling in it that I feel works, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
that
makes total sense. Yeah.
So he goes back to the future. He starts trying to woo, as we shall say, his ex-wife back, Vlad's dead wife. And then I'm not too savvy about Vlad doing pain in real life. So did he die by the Turks
I can't remember.
So the Turkish armies are battering down his castle in Romania, and the Turkish general leader kills him, Kazara Bey, if I spelt that right. Dyslexia again. Sorry about if that's pronounced wrong. And then at the very end of the book, the love of the lot that he's reincarnated love is actually the Turkish leader that killed him in the first place. It's making
love can be cruel. I think that's what that's saying, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what he's saying. The artwork, I couldn't believe it was Mike Grell. I couldn't believe it. Just absolutely astounded, because as you said, Tony, you're a big fan. I've seen his previous work. The art, when the flashback scenes are just pencils with colour laid over it. So I think that might be Mike Grell's work. And then the painterly parts of it, like the photorealistic work, is by Rob Pryor. So, that's definitely a not get one.
Right, okay. So who wrote it? Sorry, Grell wrote it as well, did he?
Yeah, it says stories and pencils, artist Rob Pryor, art assistants Tony Martin, photographer Matthew Baker, art.
Right, that's a lot, isn't it?
Photographer. Okay.
Rob Barrera, Dan Godfrey, and Jack Hasty. You know,
it must have been on one of those days where Todd was busy. You know, he nipped off to go and buy another expensive baseball.
Well, I think he's too busy making toys, because it's got a massive 1997 toy advert at the back of it.
Do you remember they did some, was it trading cards they did of all the image creators? And his one, he had his shirt off and was hitting a baseball with a baseball bat or something. Is that right?
You tell me. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with hitting a baseball with your shirt off.
Yeah. We've all done it.
Yeah.
I didn't even have a bat.
Hitting balls with your shirts off. Oh, God, sorry. I went too far there.
Now, I'd like to also, at this point, be nice about Todd McFarlane. Because at the same convention that Matt met Rob Liefeld, I met Todd McFarlane, and he was really nice to me.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And he pointed at me and went, "Who's this guy?" Like that to me. And I went, "Oh.
You're just like everyone else."
Yes, I know.
He kind of realised, I presume, like the kind of businessman aspect that we mentioned earlier, that he realised that the real money wasn't in the comic. It was in the merchandising.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he just went to that.
On the Image documentary, I think it's Silvestri mentions that him and Jim Lee had, as he put it, the chops for business. Right. So as soon as they started, Image started, they were the two who really knew their
stuff.
Let's
not forget, like, Spawn was number one comic of all comics for a very, very long time.
Yeah. And there's still issues. That's one of the few issues that's still worth something in the back issue bins. So you've got, I think the Cerebus issue is going to be worth something. You've got the Angela issues that are still worth something.
Yeah.
You know, I think they still go for a reason. I mean, Team Youngblood, you can buy on eBay for £1 a piece, you know, but the other stuff, I don't know. Well,
I got a lot of my Youngblood what I can find of it, and Brigade and all that sort of stuff, in newsagents that would sell 5 comics for £1 in a bundle.
Yeah.
At the time in the 90s. So, because when I was growing up, I used to have to buy my comic books in the newsagents across the road from me. So, but yeah. They didn't get specific titles in. So, eventually, there was a comic book shop opened up in Watford, and I could get there. And that's when I started buying Curse of Spawn, which I'll talk about.
And let's face it, a lot of the Image books, you didn't really need to read a series of them. You just get away with an issue and getting as much as you needed out of it, couldn't you?
Yeah.
You know. Well,
I remember seeing the a making of for the film Spawn, and that's what got me into it. So I didn't really get Spawn bandwagon, I think, until issue 30.
I don't mind that film. I don't mind it at all. No, I watched it again about a year ago. It's schlocky VHS kind of movie, but I kind of liked it. It's nice that it exists, you know.
I did watch a kind of a behind-the-scenes thing that someone did, or kind of like a look at the film.
Right.
And basically, that New Line had to argue Todd McFarlane down from it being an R. They were like, you can't have an R.
Yeah.
And it's like, fucking hell.
That's a shame.
It's like Spawn's a dude coming back from hell who's a fucking mercenary hitman.
Yeah.
And it's after a certain point, no one gets shot. You don't see people getting shot.
Okay, because they did that with... I mean, obviously, they did that years later with Deadpool. They argued that that should be an R, and it was a very successful one, wasn't it? You know. But
I think they should have gone that route for the film, but there we go.
He's trying to make an R-rated film now, I believe. He's trying to do the proper version that he saw.
Do you think that will ever happen? Though? I mean, we hear about films being in limbo forever. And I've heard about Spawn being remade, as it were, for probably about 10 years.
I like the animation. I've got to say, the animation I really like. Thought worked really well.
I was about to mention that, I think that's probably the most faithful adaptation of his book.
Yeah. And it had little bits with him in it as well. He was sort of at the drawing board talking to you a bit, didn't it, as well?
That had
Keith David as the voice of Spawn.
Yeah, it's fucking brilliant voice.
Yeah.
Well, that was a HBO TV show, so back in the 90s. Okay. I remember that.
Because a lot of the Spawn themes were adult. I mean, the chap with the ice cream, he was a child molester, if I was thinking right. Is that correct? I mean, that would tie into Curse of Spawn.
Yeah, well,
some of the themes of like, whoa, this is.
Yeah, and like,
there's no kind of warning on the comic that you're getting this kind of story. Like, one minute they're running around with pouches and shooting people, and the next minute this story kind of like, fucking hell. That's
Violator, the bad guy, would just rip people's hearts out. Like, quite.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Ah, good days.
that's quite a good segue to the Curse of Spawn. Like, this 4-issue run. It's about Sam and Twitch. If you don't know, it's the detectives in the Spawn universe.
And they had their own series, didn't they, as well? I think Bendis wrote it, didn't he?
Yeah. I've never read that and don't know what that's like.
I've heard it. It's quite good. I think
Capullo drew some of it, didn't he? It was very good. I liked it. Yeah.
Well, there's a really good Capullo series. Is it called The Creech?
You talked about this to me the other day, didn't you?
I couldn't find my issues of it. That's a good example, which... as we said earlier, that's a really good example from the 90s that I really liked and I can still read today from that era. But this Curse of Spawn run is really dark and really just downright nasty, really. I'll try and sum it up really quickly because it's really convoluted. I think there's about 4 storylines going at the same time. But before that, stories by Alan McElroy. And pencils are by Dwayne Turner, and inks by Danny Meakey. Is it Danny Meakey?
Yeah.
I think he still inks him. He inks Capullo now, doesn't he? Yeah. I think.
Really?
Alan McElroy did a lot of Spawn stuff as well. I think he wrote the Spawn film.
Yeah, I did a bit of research. Yeah, he was a writer for the Spawn film, Halloween 4, Resident Evil. So he's got a film.
Quite a pedigree. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Wrong Turn. All the Wrong Turn films he did as well.
Oh, I like them.
Down here. Yeah, so I'm going to go to one specific book in the part of the book, if you don't mind. Is that all right?
Of course,
because there's one bit where before the opening of the comic is a guy writing in his journal, and he's talking about how he's an alien and basically how he needs to cleanse the world. He's in a calf and he shoots everyone in the calf, and it quite vicious. You see a lady with her blood coming out of her head, brains coming out of her head, Then he goes to the toilet, and there's a child in there, and he kills the child. You see him shoot the child in the head.
Fucking
and
hell.
What this guy wants to do is cut out the eyes of everyone that he meets. So he cuts out all their eyes and keeps them as trophies, and that's in the first four pages, you see that.
What year did this issue come out in?
Let me just... 96.
I would not be surprised. It was really at the height of... Obviously, Spawn, Sam and Twitch especially, those sort of stories went into really dark and really messed up territory. It was also at that time that we had films like Seven... And the whole serial killer, you know, the real twisted mind fuck, you know, we're going to show you something sick. You know, way before things like Saw and stuff, it was real, really dark stuff like that, wasn't it?
I really liked Seven as a film.
Seven's a great film.
But I think they've watched, by the looks of it, they've watched Seven and they thought, let's up the ante, if that makes sense. And I think, well, it doesn't really work because I thought Seven's quite suspenseful without showing everything on screen, but this shows you everything in the comic book.
Yeah,
so,
a lot of people don't get that, do they? Like some of the, for instance, the Saw franchise, the first film, you don't really see that much, but it's got like this huge reputation for being a gore fest.
Yeah.
It's no Hostel, is it?
No,
definitely. Yeah, it gets talked about in the same breath, and it ain't no Hostel, got to hear.
One of my favourite films is Halloween, the very first one. Literally no blood in that film whatsoever. Yeah. It's just dead body, if that makes sense. So, that's what we're saying. And then the Sam and Twitch turn up, they start investigating, and then it goes on to another storyline about a young, pretty lady who's living in Manhattan, walks into this cafe where this man has killed everybody and seen him take everybody's eyes out. So she runs away in fear, gets run over by a police car because she's run out in the middle of the road, gets taken... by the ambulance and by the police car, and then later on, she's still unconscious, and then later on is proceeded to be raped by the two policemen and the two paramedics in there.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I tell you what, you talking about this reminds me, because I think I've got like the first 8 or 9 issues of Curse of Spawn, and I can remember getting it, but I didn't read it, and then a couple of years later I did, and I was like, holy fuck. The first issues are nothing like that, the first 1, 2, or 3.
Well, with 96, I was like, either 11 or 12. I was thinking, how on earth did I buy this comic with my pocket money? You know? Mm-hmm. And, it's just a really nasty comic. And there's no... I know this sounds really horrible, because I don't want to slate anyone's work, because obviously you all have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a really nasty comic. Wasn't hard to read, which I've said earlier. I did actually follow it bit by bit, but I'm looking at images now, which I think I don't think there's a rating on it. There's nothing to say on the front issue to say.
Yeah, a lot of companies didn't do it then, did they? Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of companies still don't, do they? You know.
I think
it probably says a lot for McElroy's work that you could read it. You know what I mean? It was.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the graphic images that leave a sour taste in the mouth.
Yeah, it's just, and then it goes on to another. They take her to an ex-boxer who's a killer, who goes out killing people as well. So there's quite a few serial killers. And then eventually this lady is stitched back up together and she goes on a killing spree of trying to kill all the serial killers. And that's the long and the short of it, really. I'm not really a big fan of the artwork, to be honest with you. But it's really muddy, I think,
right,
if that makes sense. Like the colour tone. It just makes New York look like... probably works, which is probably part of the job. It makes New York like the most dive hole place ever imaginable. But the artwork really doesn't appeal to me. And there's varying differences in it. So, like, from page to the other, the quality isn't as good as, if that makes sense. There's
the quality sort of drops and
goes up. Yeah, it's really weird. I don't know if that's a filling page or what have you. But it's just. To me, this comic typifies what I don't like about the 90s now, if that makes sense.
I think it's also an example of, like, the 90s, when these things started, they were fresh and new. But then, all of these sort of titles went into extremes. It's like, you know, the Spawn was a dark one, so people were really pushed it. By the end of the 90s, they were really pushing it into dark areas.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Or you had certain comics that, you know, they were over the top with their characters, and they just kept pushing it in that direction. You know, it's like it was almost like the original subject matter almost wasn't strong enough, and then they're trying to push it in an area that's giving it new life, so you have to make it hardcore.
That's what that Shadowhawk was about. It was like he went around crippling people, wasn't it? Breaking their back.
Breaking their spines.
And then it revealed that he had HIV positive, or he had AIDS or something.
That was such a strange turn, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I'm still a bit flummoxed by about why they did that. It was,
and also
I just never understood it.
Yeah, and also I think it's fair enough to have that, but that has to have some sort of, you know, the story has to go somewhere, and it has to have some sort of resonance. I never read any of it, so I don't know how strong that story was to accompany that. But
the art was great. I have to say, nice, clean art, a little bit simplistic, because I liked his Guardians of the Galaxy stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was okay. Yeah. It just, there wasn't enough of it for me. You were invested in a lot of stories, which you can say for Spawn and Savage Dragon. If you're invested in the story, it will keep coming at you.
Yeah.
But a lot of stuff like Shadowhawk and like the Extreme Studios stuff, and like especially like Wildcats, is you got really invested in it from the first couple of issues, and you'd wait like 6 months sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, and you think, well, where has it gone to?
Yeah.
You know.
Say the Curse of Spawn, the first three issues are complete. There's nothing to do with kind of this, almost like an Elseworlds tale. And
right,
I don't know if you guys have read it.
I've got those.
Yeah, I really like those ones because it's kind of hell's taken over Earth, and like one last spawn's brought back to kind of finish off humanity.
Right,
and he kind of like turns on his masters, and I think the end of the last three issues is him sort of saying, fuck you, I'm fighting back against this, whatever, and then it just stops.
Yeah, they had some nice sort of twists on it. Like, I remember there was Witchblade, and you had the medieval Witchblade who met medieval Spawn, and they had a crossover. You know, I thought that was pretty cool. There were some interesting things being done, definitely.
Well, I think after this run of the Curse of Spawn, so after issue 8, I think it was issue 9, who's the angel that's now part of the Marvel Universe?
Angela.
Yeah, she had a bit of a run, which isn't too bad. And the stuff that Dan spoke about, I think that's like a galaxy sort of one. So like there's wars going on Mars and stuff like that in the first three issues. Like it's like a space sort of one. So that one was quite good. But this run, I didn't connect to it. But I think that's probably my taste in stories and stuff like that now. But
trying to be Edgelord before Edgelord was even invented.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's a nasty, but not. I'm not saying on purpose, but I don't think it's come across maybe in a way that it's supposed to. I think it's quite nasty. It's a nasty read, if that makes sense.
I understand.
Twitch and Sam are trying to do the good job, but they're not actually in it a lot on that run. And they're the two characters who are like the heart, like the good guys in the book.
Yeah.
And everyone else isn't, you know. So, yeah. Yeah.
I say on the flip side, we talk about Image, like you mentioned Eric Larson, that Savage Dragon is one that just absolutely took me the moment it came out. It's still going strong.
Yeah. It's still well written. It's still good. Yeah.
I think he's, I don't know if he's still doing it. He was drawing issues of Spawn as well.
Yeah.
Recently.
Isn't he on course to, he's already beaten the Cerebrus run of, is it 300 issues?
I don't know actually.
I'm sure he was gunning for it, or he went past it recently.
Right, okay.
Like create your own, drawing his own comic for a consecutive run.
Yeah.
Again, that Image documentary, he's not actually in it a lot, but he talks about Savage Dragon, and he's got a statue, you know, you get the statues, and he's so proud of it. He's so happy that he's still doing it by the looks of it. It's like, I think the words is, this is Savage Dragon, and God damn it, it's the greatest thing ever. And like, his love for it.
He's probably the most approachable. Yeah, he's probably the most approachable as well of the lot. In my experience, we see him every year in New York, don't we, Matt?
Yeah, he's just
sitting there and chatting.
He's drawing pages, isn't he? I think.
Yeah.
When he's not got anyone at his table, he reminded
me on Twitter because I used Vanguard, and he's obviously got a character called Vanguard.
Oh, really?
It's
not the best Vanguard. Dan Butcher does the best Vanguard, which is
vanguardcomic.com. Well, thank you.
But I think he was the, if the Image documentary again is right, he's the guy who gave Kirkman his first sort of way into comics, something to do with a killer pope or something.
Battle Pope,
that's it, yeah. And he used Savage Dragon in one of his books, and that's
he was editor-in-chief at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah,
and that's how he got into that sort of crew sort of thing.
Nice one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Done.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. I kind of not. I've got Spawn, I think, 1 to 150. I mentioned this before, but I really struggled, apart from a few highlights like the Angela Cerebus issue. Spawn stories, this kind of, for me, it didn't ever really go anywhere.
Yeah, like, I liked it when it was an angel. I think when Capullo was drawing him and he became an angel for a short amount of time. I think visually that was quite interesting.
The Capullo stuff is fantastic on the comics.
Well, Capullo's just got better and better. With year after year, I think.
Yeah, he's less really cartoony now as well, I think.
Yeah, unless no blight on him, you know. He's just got better and better since he started.
And he had a long run on Spawn as well. He did have He didn't mess about, did he? He stayed with it.
There's some of that stuff where I can remember one where Spawn, I've just talked about how I don't remember it, but I do remember a bit of the art, where he gets all done up in all these guns and stuff, and he's got the cape tied around his face with and a one eye magnifier on, done by Capullo.
I remember that. That's brilliant. Yeah, I know so good. About now, Dan. But I remember I actually didn't mind the Batman Spawn crossovers.
Okay,
there's two. Obviously, there's one by the DC and then one drawn by McFarlane.
Frank Miller and Tom McFarlane did.
That's it.
The Batman Spawn.
That's definitely the stronger one of the two.
The Tom McFarlane ones, I looked at it the other day, I read it the other day, and it's not too bad. It's passable sort of thing as one single story.
He did what he said, and I think of everyone, is he the one who hasn't worked for anyone else again? He hasn't worked for Marvel or DC again? I've got a feeling he is.
Yeah, I think so,
So
interesting.
There you go, that was our experiences. But let's stop and have another ad break. Tony.
Funny you should mention that. I've got an ad here for what came out from Lightning Comics in 1997, and it's referred to as someone eating a Smarties.
And I'm just getting a Jaffa cake.
And it's referred to as the hottest new comic of the month. That's saying something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wasn't clearly a big fucking month. So hold on to your heart. The Princess of Hell is looking for love, and Daddy ain't happy about it. This is issue one of Cyntha, which is spelled S-I-N-T-H-A.
Who's the publisher?
Lightning Comics, that amazing comic company. Yeah. And with the first issue, you get what is described as a poseable action figure of Cyntha, which is in amazing detail. I've got to tell you, looking at the picture, it ain't.
Issue one, you get a figure. Okay.
I think they went to comic shops. I think they'd buy them separately, but yeah, went to comic shops. And it's got a hell sword, there's a hyphen, actually slides into sheath. That's good, isn't it?
That's what I want to do with my hell swords.
Yeah. I started reading the little blurb on it. It's by Adam Perry, Anderson and Gorilla. That's who it's by. I don't know what that means. Cyntha, the 18-year-old daughter of Lucifer. I love the fact they had to put she was 18 there.
Yeah.
That's good. Someone doesn't want to get sick, do they? Yeah. She can't live in hell anymore. She's stolen a piece of her father's dark crystal, of course she has, and used it to spy on humans, fantasizing about leaving hell to experience the most forbidden of demon emotions, love! Exclamation.
Oh, God. That sounds quite nice.
That sounds fucking brilliant.
Projectile vomit. Is this
I think so. Cyntha.
Yeah, I think it looks. Artist Rod Perry will join the ranks of Queen, Turner, and Campbell. And that's from Greg Rees, who's at Vault of Comics. There you go. Well done, Greg. How much do you get for that, mate?
Yeah. Free action figure.
Yeah. With which slides into your sheath.
Yeah.
And the next I'm going to try and find that action figure and that comic in one.
Let's do that. That's going to be our next year in New York. We've got to do it. Yeah.
Does anyone out there have this issue? If so, let us know.
Yeah.
That's all I've got to say. It's probably quite a rare shout out. I don't think anyone's going to have it, but you never know.
It must be, Vince. There's got to be.
Our listeners surprise us constantly, Matt, because they keep coming back to listen. So
we had a question sent in, didn't we?
Go on. We did.
Do you want to do the poll first?
I was going to, Dan.
Go on.
And then we'll get on the question. So the poll was, looking back on them now, what is your general opinion of the comics that came out in the 90s? Like we said, the decade has a certain reputation, so we thought we'd put a poll out. Now, we had four answers. There was awesome. I loved that era. Most of them were great. Some good. Mostly bad. And good lord, they were crap. Now, yeah. Which one do you think came out on top?
Some were good, I reckon. I'm going to say. Yeah,
mostly bad.
Yeah, I'd say some is good.
And you're absolutely right.
Hey.
Yes, some good, mostly bad was number one with 58%, which I think is fair. Second place with 26% was most of them were great. 10% went to awesome, I loved that era, and 6% said good lord they were crap.
Okay.
Interesting.
I mean, for me, it was like I'd sort of dove for cover a bit and bought other comics and, you know, Fantagraphics and all these sort of people, Kitchen Sink, and I went to them once I discovered that, you know, people were just reaching into my back pocket and pulling money out for a lot of the Image stuff. I continued reading Marvel, I continued reading DC, and that's got high and low points as well, but a lot of the indie stuff that was coming out was quite good, you know, but this stuff, you know.
Well, maybe it's more publicised, this era of having Bert, and maybe it was just the same in other decades.
I think it clearly is. There's crap in every decade.
When you've got to look at some of the stuff now, the Xenoscope stuff, but no one ever talks about that. It sells bundles, I think, apparently. Yeah. And it's like some of the sort of Glory and, you know, Vampirella and all this sort of thing. It's like some of the issues from the 90s, if you look at it, especially the covers. Yeah.
There's always going to be bad comics and there's always going to be good comics. Do you know what I mean? So,
Yeah.
So I think I mentioned earlier about the Marvel's kind of reaction to the Image stuff, and they did stuff like Thunderstrike, and then they stuck Daredevil in kind of like armor
and Force Works,
and just kind of tried to make it a bit more extreme.
I actually read Thunderstrike as a series, and I think it gets a bit of a bad rep because it was basically a more sort of grounded Thor, and he had a family, and it was sort of quite personal. The actual Thor. Like very much so, yeah. And I shout, it's hammer time when I'm going to bed with the lady.
She can hear you while you're in the spare room.
Yeah, under the covers on my own, lights out. But what they did, you spoke about it before, Dan, what they did to Thor is they made him look ridiculous during that period at little points, didn't they? Yeah, but Thunderstrike was just his sort of street level Thor. It had a sort of bit of a weird hammer. But yeah, I know what you mean. The name, though, that's the name of it, is similar to the sort of a lot of the Image stuff when it Thunderstrike and, you know.
Yeah, kind of like a lot of the design choices seem to be led by looking at Image comics.
Yeah.
And, not for the best, I don't think.
Well, as we said earlier, a lot of the guys were either Rob Liefeld, like Todd McFarlane, like, and maybe they just had the same principles of design. If that makes any sense. Yeah. So they saw things the same way. And maybe not having that variety of different artists with different styles.
I think it's Jim Lee who sort of bounces about. And I can see the appeal to Rob Liefeld and, you know, Will Sportacio and Mark Silvestri and all this sort of thing. But for me, and people are going to hate me for saying this, but it's Jim Lee who seems to bounce about making a few quid off various companies.
Yeah,
you know, he made a few quid off Marvel on the old X-Men, which was like at the time was the biggest selling comic ever. You know, made fucking a big bundle of cash. Went to Image, then he got rehired by Marvel. Then something happened, and he either got sacked or he left Marvel. And then he sold Wildstorm to DC.
Yeah,
and then DC got him with the New 52 and decided it's up to Jim Lee to design a load of the characters' costumes. Which, let's face it, we all fucking moaned about the time, and half of them looked the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I just get the. I'm actually quite surprised he's still there because I thought Jim Lee would be 5 years, take the cash and run. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't read many DC comics at the moment. I probably read the new, is it All Star Batman with John Romita? JR, whatever. But it seems to me like Jim Lee has a hold on all the characters and what, as you said, what they all look like. And
yeah.
Yeah, they look like Jim Lee characters. Even the animated films that are coming out at the moment look like all Jim Lee characters Jim Lee faces, I think. That's what I think.
What is his position at DC at the moment?
Is he
at DC? Quite up, I thought he was. He's quite high up.
Yeah, he's one of the head publishers, I think.
Yeah.
Because my son's got that Batman Lego 3, and he's in that.
Really?
For the DC bigwigs, like there's about five or six of them, you can unlock them as Lego characters, and he's in that.
Is it as good as an after show party in the Def Leppard Rock and Roll Special?
Nothing can be.
Probably not.
Yeah, nothing can beat that.
No, yeah. So we had a couple of comments based on that poll. Paul Moore at pmoore121 said UK comics had a Crisis, Toxic, Deadline, Marvel UK 2000 AD had just run Zenith, Button Man, Devlin War. Have I said that right?
Yep. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Vertigo kicked off. Let's not forget Vertigo.
Yeah, I think that was the backlash almost, wasn't it? We had.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to refer to him as Brainless. People can write in and hate me. We had Brainless Image in certain aspects, and then we had, you know, very sort of cerebral Vertigo, didn't we? We had Sandman and, you know, Egypt and, you know, Books of Magic and all this sort of stuff was going on, which was clever, you know, Shade the Changing Man, all this sort of thing. Just beautiful, beautiful stuff. You know.
Mark Lamming at Monkey Mark, he also brought up another few great comics from the 90s. It's like Kane, he mentioned Vertigo again.
Paul Grist, yeah.
Bone. Who can forget Bone? Storyteller, From Hell, Exit, Cerebus.
I think Stray Bullets as well might be from that.
Yeah.
From the 90s.
Yeah, Minimum Wage, obviously.
Yeah.
Same period. Yeah. Box Office Poison. Yeah, there's loads of stuff.
So there's lots of stuff. And Mark also goes on to say, sir, but there were a lot of really poor superheroes and sexist crap, bad girl comics that got too much oxygen.
Yeah.
That, there's
quite a few of them still around today.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're not like what was that comic you just mentioned, Tony? Cyntha.
Cyntha.
That was the peak of it. You got a figure with it, you know.
I've got a better one than that coming up.
Oh my word. Chris Imber brought up something interesting though, at @reckless_Imber. I think he's a child of the 90s, like some of us out there. Jim Lee and Claremont were killing it on X-Men. Gen X, fun superheroes, and deaths and rebirths were big events.
Okay. Death of Superman. Death of Superman. I actually really like the storyline, Death of Superman. I think it still holds up today. Mm. There's a great audio play you can get download that's really, really well done. All about that.
Because there's a whole, obviously after his death, there's a whole massive story after that, isn't there? Before he comes back, which I remember as a kid.
I remember going down the shop every week, just trying to find the next part of that because I was so gripped.
Yeah, so, I was as well. Yeah. And you didn't know who was going to be the cyborg or, you know, the clone or, you know, who was going to be the real one.
The bit where the cyborg blasts through, like, the Eradicator Superman. Yeah. And I was like, holy fuck. Didn't see it coming.
And you had Steel, which led to that extremely good movie with Shaquille.
Nearly as good as Carver Dark Hero, but, you know. Nearly. Yeah.
That's awesome. Nearly,
but I was on the other side on the Batman Night Quest or Nightfall.
Oh, I like that as well. Yeah. Really like that.
I love that.
Was that one where he was in the big armor?
Yeah.
Well, it's the whole Bane breaking his back, and then
I rereading that, I wasn't such a fan of that.
See the John Paul Valley Batman. You're not supposed to like that armor.
Yeah,
right. Like that's the whole thing of it. Like he gets the new Batman armor, redesigns it himself.
And you're not supposed to like him, are you? Because
he's an arsehole.
Yeah.
Read the Azrael 100 issues. Azrael, I've said this before. Azrael, the solo series, they turn him into a likable character. He's one of the best standalone 100 issues. So well done.
Also, really. Azrael's got a quality design, I think.
Oh yeah,
brilliant. God, yeah.
I've got the Sword of Azrael in front of me now.
Fantastic,
and that's really good. But with
that Quesada,
I remember buying that as a little. My mum buying me that for a little boy because I just thought looking through it without reading it, it was just incredible.
It was a big event miniseries. That I mean, I remember people going nuts for that series.
I think when it came out, it went under the radar because they didn't make a big deal of how big Azrael was going to be.
Mm.
And then they announced it, and everyone was like, "Holy fuck!" And they kind of went mad trying to get it because they knew it was going to be a big player.
Yeah, that's also a great audiobook if you can get it. The BBC did it. Sorry, Radio 1, I think, did it in like 3-minute bits on Radio 1.
Oh, wow.
They put it all together on a disc. It's really good. Really well made.
Because as we were saying earlier, like there's more 90s stuff that I like than I hate, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I grew up and maybe want to try and be an artist and try and draw comics.
You see the influence a lot in the small press of the 90s. You really do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I think, like we say, it's an easy go-to to, you know, to say, oh, 90s comics because of the chrome covers, the holofoil covers. But then when someone goes, what about Vertigo? And you suddenly realise, shit,
Yeah.
Vertigo was a name that kept coming up in the comments and the messages. Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, we didn't do this as an episode looking at 90s. We were like having
we just thought, let's have a laugh. And just
let's have a laugh at some bad comics. Yeah, yeah.
Well, was it Tank Girl the 90s as well? I love Tank Girl. That's one of my favourite.
I believe it was. Yeah,
Deadline in there. Deadline magazine. You know?
Yeah. But you like you say, Crisis. I have to say, 2000 AD did have a dip in quality a couple of times. I almost did a couple of 2000 AD stories as my choice this week, but I thought, leave them alone for the moment.
Yeah, I had a few lined up for that because I've got quite a few from the 90s because that was the only comic I could buy from newsagents regularly each week. You know, so I've got quite a decent run on that. But as I said, I think there's a lot more good than is portrayed from the 90s out there, sort of thing, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
That segues quite nicely into the question we got sent in by Brian Vander, friend of the show.
Ah, cool.
So, question one. What is your favourite 90s comic artist that you don't like as much today?
Right, I'm going to say... Oh, this is going to be another... Jim
Lee. We'll do Vince, Matt, Tony.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm going to say Jim Lee. And that's not to say that I don't necessarily like him. I just think his art hasn't really gone anywhere.
I'd agree.
It hasn't developed yet. You know, we talk about some of these people like Capullo and... You know, certainly like Humberto Ramos came up in the 90s as well, and you see what he's doing now. It's unbelievable. Whereas Jim Lee, it's almost like he's had that sort of house style. And beautiful though it is when you see the pencils. It doesn't... Everyone kind of still looks the same. Everyone's still got that cookie cutter sort of face.
Yeah, I think he's always been a great... I mean, he's a great draftsman. He knows the human body. He can draw it really, really well.
Yeah.
I just think his sequentials aren't as good as people think, and I'd have to go for him as well. And I think if he stuck to covers, I'd be fine. I think he does some great covers.
Yeah.
You only got to look at a couple of the Wildcats covers I was looking at a minute ago. You know, the first few of those are really iconic. You know, well made covers.
And how many people, even though how many people have based their style on Jim Lee, or when they started drawing, they tried doing Jim Lee. I certainly did. I copied his style many times trying to come up with my own characters when I was first trying to draw. Well, I say first trying to draw, but you know when you start thinking about your own sort of comic characters and stuff, probably like in your teens and stuff. It was always almost a Jim Lee sort of template kind of thing that
I
went for.
Yeah, I think mine would have to be Todd McFarlane because I was buying Spawn on a regular basis. And obviously I don't think he does a lot now, does he really? But it's not changed at all. Yeah. I think what was a recent sort of Spawn ripoff that he actually created a few years back? And it to me it just looked like he hadn't developed any further. Is that right? I did drop out of comics after that time. After I started buying Image Comics, I got a bit older. Turned into a grumpy teenager.
And a lot of people say that as well, because this sort of era, you really get into it, and then you get burnt out, or
that jumps into question three.
Yeah.
Question three is: did the late 90s nearly ruin comics for you? And I think we've covered.
I became exasperated a little bit around stuff, but there was still enough strong stuff out there that kept me going. I think. I listened to Word Balloon, and John Suntris makes a point of saying because he dropped out of comics and came back in the 2000s.
I would say that I wouldn't say that comics, it was nearly ruined for me. I mean, I just naturally dropped out of it. There wasn't any one thing that really just made me say, oh, I'm done with comics. I always loved comics, but also they weren't readily available to me. You know, there wasn't... You know, when comics died away, I wasn't getting the Marvel comics in my local newsagent and stuff like that. So just naturally, it kind of faded away.
The direct market sales thing, I think, is as much responsible for killing children's interest in comics. You know, when it went from being, like you say, Vince, you and I would go to newsagents and buy comics. And then there was a period where you had to just search out a comic shop. And not everywhere had one. You know, not everywhere has them now, certainly.
I would... going to mention the favorite 90s comic artist, Eric Larson's. This sounds a bit dodgy, but Eric Larson's work when he was on Spider-Man in the first kind of start of the run of Savage Dragon, the artwork is a lot tighter.
Everything is hyper detailized. So good.
Yeah. And if you compare it to now, his artwork now is not really my cup of tea. It's a lot looser, not as detailed and stuff. And that's nothing bad. You can do your art the way you like. But when it was back in the day like that, it's absolutely fantastic.
I suppose there's artists that we remember fondly for certain periods of time, and then we fall out of love with a bit. Yeah. Everyone's gonna fucking hate me for this, but I used to really like Art Adams, but now I'm not overly fussed. I think people have reached that. There's a lot of artists who do very detailed stuff like that, and I find art, is super detailed. And back then, stuff like his X-Men annuals and stuff were beautiful, but I just find his face is very samey now.
They are, yeah.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll pop on to question two. Favorite image comic of the 90s?
Oh, interesting. Ooh,
image comic. Mine would be... Do you know what? I would have to say the Cyberforce series, because that was one that really ignited, because I had got it from the beginning. It was one that I went into, sort of mind, body, and soul. It was like my series, because it wasn't one of the ones that got really talked about too much. You had the Spawns, the Young Bloods, the Wildcats, but Cyberforce was kind of off to the side, sort of doing its own thing. So it felt like it was more, when you like a band before anyone else likes them, and you're like, they're mine, it's all mine. That's what Cyberforce felt like. And so I've got fond memories of it, even though I won't read it now. I won't go back and read it, because I don't want to spoil it. spoil it for myself. But that whole Top Cow universe, Cyberforce hooked me in with that, which meant that, I followed them all the way until sort of quite a few issues into The Darkness. I was reading The Darkness for quite some time. So Cyberforce, I'd say that.
Okay, I'm going to say, here's an easy one for me. Martial Law, Savage Dragon.
That's a good one.
Yeah, so Pat Mills, Kevin O'Neill. Yeah,
nice one.
Nice. Dan?
The Oasis of Fond Memories, the Savage Dragon, the first four issues trade. I got taken up by my aunt to London, and we went into Forbidden Planet, and she bought me it. And I've read it so many times that day.
Hold up? Because I saw that in Nottingham. It was in a cheap trade section, and I was so close to getting it, the first trade.
The first
you were, weren't you? That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
They did some black and white essentials, didn't they, for a while? You could there for a while. I think the first three or four, they did three or four sort of phone books of them, which are quite cool. But yeah, I'd love to see a colour. Just bring them all out in trade. I'd buy them. I'd eat them up.
I would. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
What about you, Matt?
I think I mentioned it earlier. The Capello Creech. First, I think it's three issues. Was it the Creech? Yeah, that really. I read that a couple of weeks ago. Actually, I can't seem to find it now. But that really stayed with me for some reason. I really like the artwork actually. And it was one of the comics around about that time that I actually carried on. I know it's only three issues, but for a teenage kid with little money, that was what I saved my money to get, because I really enjoyed it. And I read it back the other day, and I just thought, it's just a good comic. I thought,
okay. Yeah. Well, how about this then? Let me pose this one. What's your favourite image book at the moment?
Actually, The Fix. That's what it'll be for me.
Okay.
That was a really difficult question, because most of the trades that I get now are Image, and a lot of the books I get are Image books.
Yeah.
But The Fix.
Dan?
Mine's going to be Invincible, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Glory, I got that a couple of years ago, and I reread it all the time. It's fantastic. Brilliant. And Matt? Profit, that's great.
I like Headlopper.
Good.
Yeah,
that's really good. That's from Image and McLean. I don't know, what's Stray Bullets on though? Because I still read that today. I still get that. That's not on Image, is it?
I thought it just came back, didn't it?
I've got one in front of me now. Yeah, so it's a toss up between Stray Bullets and Headlopper, really.
Okay. For me, it'd either be Invisible Republic by Gabriel Hardman, I really, really like Warren Ellis, and I can't remember for my life, the artist.
Trees?
On Trees, yeah.
Jason Howard, one of my favourite artists.
Just most beautiful storytelling. You know, just incredible stuff. Like such inflection of emotion, and you know, all sorts of things. Really, really worth getting. I think it's only up to about issue 11 or 12 now. It's worth getting in trade. Very good. Yeah. There you go.
Should we have another advert?
Oh yeah. Right, this is also coming from this issue of Previews from 1997. Vampire Erotica, number 30. Out of the world-famous Brainstorm Comics, who also gave us the comics Vampire Necromantique, issue 1, and the Blonde Avenger.
That's a good issue, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah, very good. Yeah. I've never seen a woman with tits further apart. They're almost on the sides of her body. And then there's Blonde Avenger, Dangerous Conclusions, number 1. In Vampire Erotica 30, this issue, the conclusion to the story with the deadly vampire aliens, which were first introduced in Legends of Lexuria 1, obviously. Also, the Blood Hunter interrupts... I don't know what that means. Also, the Blood Hunter interrupts what would have been a pleasant evening and closes in on Elan Vital and Mercedes. She'd have to be called Mercedes, wouldn't she? Do you know what I mean? For the kill. Yeah, it's basically a woman sitting on her side. You get quite a big chunk of side boob. She's holding a bloodied necklace into a sort of goblet of blood. Yeah, that speaks
so volumes. They're nice. Their kind of quiet night or whatever. It would not like tapas in a film.
Hang on. Let's just stop for a second. Dan, did you just say tapas in a film? That you how middle class are you? Tapas. Who has tapas with a film?
I can't bear tapas. If food turns up on the table, that's mine. I'm not sharing.
We have to stop, Cannibal Holocaust, darling. I've run out of chili hummus.
Falafel.
Weird, I had tapas with you the other day, Matt. You tapas, you're a hipster, I knew it.
No, it's Turkish. Is that the same thing?
Yeah.
Is that how Tapastic got its name? Is
it? I wondered that the other day, because their emails come in tapas, don't they?
Tapastic.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Right.
If you know, right into the show.
Yeah.
So many questions we're going to get. Actually, we got a couple of little questions, so just briefly... Before we sign off, we said, is there any questions you want to see discussed? Now, a lot of people just mentioned the comics that they liked. One I thought that Alan Henderson mentioned, which I thought was quite good, that always gets over. I think it's a bit overlooked these days. Kingdom Come. That came out in the 90s.
And Marvels. I think Marvels
and Kingdom Come. That was Alex Ross's one-two really punch that he's basically made a career off, isn't it, really?
I've got his art book of the Gatchaman, Battle of the Planets.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Because he did all the covers, I think, for a limited run. Yeah, he's got a bit of a thing for that. And Flash Gordon.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of others. Mo_Ali on Twitter, just said, 90s costumes. What do you think of those?
Yeah, some of them. Yeah. We've talked about a bit about them, haven't we, in the Liefeld verse?
It wasn't just Liefeld, because...
Oh, no, it's Jim Lee and
Marvel, Marvel characters. I remember there was an Invisible Woman character costume design. You know the one I'm talking about, where she's missing half of her costume, really?
The floor was like a boob window on her chest.
It's who thought that was a good idea?
And let's face it, we haven't talked enough about Marvel UK. They had some fucking atrocious costume designs, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think someone just literally spat colour onto a costume. I'm looking at one which is in Genetics, with a big X on the end, because that obviously sold. She's got a yellow face, a blue mask, purple hair, golden shoulder pads, and green legs. That's going some, isn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, Sam Webster at SJ Webster Art, he simply said, shoulder pads.
Oh, yeah. He likes a shoulder pad, doesn't he? I've seen him at conventions.
He's constantly wearing an 80s suit. No, but shoulder pad design, you know, we'll bring it up again. Profit, I think. Profit probably had more shoulder pads and pouches than I think.
Well, in the Young Blood, they all had those cavalier boots, you know, the kind of like the really long ones that are pulled down.
Yeah. And what was those funny helmets that they used to have that used to cover their chin and like just show their face, like a pouch for your head? you know? Yeah, it's just like, I think Rob Liefeld just thought, oh, I've got pouches everywhere, let's put a pouch on his head.
That is the greatest thing I've ever heard.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, a pouch for your head. The debut album from Matt Harrower. So, yeah, in short, there was a lot of things that went wrong in the 90s, but there's an awful lot of brilliant comics out there.
Can I say some recommendations that are a bit, not obscure, but like runs from the 90s? Both from Marvel, actually. These are actually the first two runs that I ever bought as a kid, as from my newsagents, that I could actually get a decent enough run on. So, there's an Incredible Hulk four-parter from issue 413 to 416 called The Trojan War, and I love it. It's got the space, Star Slammer, is it Star Slammers? Silver Surfer turns up, you know, like every Marvel cosmic Marvel character you can think of pretty much turns up to fight with the Hulk in space for every issue. So that's really good. If you can get hold of those four issues, I really recommend it. I think, like, I saw them at a recent con for like £4 each. But yeah, it's just really loads of fun, loads of action. Even Doctor Strange is in it. A weird Doctor Strange, like a Skinhead, pops up out of the fridge at one point. I read that this morning. And then my very first comic I bought from newsagents was The Invincible Iron Man issue 291.
Yeah. Right.
And I really like that series. There's loads. I'm a massive action buff, so, like, as I said, the dyslexia from, like, just reading the pictures, looking at the pictures, I could read the story, and I think it does it really well. Loads of action in it. It's when Tony Stark is disabled, I think, and he's just lying in the bed with the headset controlling Iron Man, but you get Thor turns up, Venom, the Hulk.
Of course Venom turns up. Yeah.
Turns up. Omega Red turns up at one point. Modok turns up. And then there's a really good two-issue run where he goes into space and fights the Technovore, which has taken over a whole spaceship. And, yeah, just really good, fun comics, you know what I mean? Like, as a kid growing up, those were the type of comics that I'd love to read, and a really fun, sort of, like, really, not campy, but, like, really imaginative, loads of colour and just out there sort of thing.
Obviously we joke about the holofoil covers and the chrome and the embossing and all of that, but I used to really like some of them. In the 90s is responsible for one of my fave covers at the time. It was very simple, but when War Machine got its own series, do you remember this?
Yeah.
And it was a black and silver embossed sort of cover of just the War Machine, the classic sort of
I remember that.
Yeah, and it just looked really striking.
Yeah.
The series started off strong and then just got a little bit generic. It's one of those series where they seem to put a guest star in every issue, which obviously bodes well about your character.
Marvel UK did that, didn't they? I think X-Men or Gambit, you know, or Wolverine or someone turned up in most fucking issues, didn't they?
Yeah.
Just to bump sales a bit. Yeah.
I've written down the artists and the writers for both the Iron Man and the Hulk run. There are artists. He's someone called Len Kamagsky, if I'm pronouncing that right, and penciler Kevin Hopgood.
He's still going.
For the Iron Man. And then The Trojan War is by Peter David, written by Peter David, and pencils by Gary Frank and inks by Cam Smith.
I was going to say it's Gary Frank, because that was the Smart Hulk, wasn't it? He was.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gangster Hulk and all that sort of thing.
I do remember that. That was very good.
Though. Wasn't there somebody that Dale Keown? I can't remember his
name. Dale Keown was.
He did Pitt, didn't he?
Yeah. He was. He did a run of the Hulk when it was the Grey Hulk, I remember. And then he left. He joined Image, didn't he, at the beginning?
Yeah, he did.
Just shortly after it started, yeah.
I always loved his artwork on the Hulk.
Yeah, I did as well. Yeah.
I've got the first run on Pitt, but.
Yeah, he's done some work on The Darkness, which is astonishing.
Of course he did. Yeah, did he do some stuff with Malibu? I've got a feeling, did he go over and do some Prime or something like that, I think?
Yeah.
Over at Malibu as well, yeah.
God, I remember going into a local comic book shop, Floppy Tongue in Salisbury, no longer there, And when they had like a, one of those huge comic book sort of sales, you know, where issues are 50p, and when you're younger, it's like a gold mine, isn't it? When you have those sort of sales, you're like, oh, you know, I've got £5, I could get loads of comics. And I remember I picked up loads of Malibu issues,
right?
And I think Prime was probably my favourite.
Prime.
I can't tell you too much about Prime. I think it's a character I want to sort of.
He was a sort of Captain Marvel type character, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But he was almost like he had this weird. He was made out of some sort of weird gelatin, wasn't he?
Norm Braveheart did it, didn't he?
That's the one. Yeah, burst out of his chest, and he became like massive.
Yeah.
The firearm was good. Nightman, that was so good. It became a short-lived TV series, didn't it?
Yeah.
You know, then they joined with Marvel, didn't they? Then they had Juggernaut go and the Black Knight go over and join them, I think, and became part of that universe or something. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. The all new Exiles. That's it. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And what didn't Barry Windsor Smith do one?
Yeah, he did. Rune. Beautiful stuff. Yeah, yeah. Oh. He didn't do them all. I think someone else took over later on, and they did a couple of crossovers, didn't they, with Rune?
Yeah.
And a couple of other non. They did a crossover with Adam Warlock, didn't they? There was a rumour Adam Warlock story.
Ah.
Yeah.
Nice.
I found some gold. Would you like me to do a quick advert?
Let's have one more advert, shall we?
This I wasn't going to do another one, but I found this, and it cannot be ignored. It's from Blatant Comics, from previews again, 1997. Babes of Area 51, issue 1.
Sorry. Go on.
What are the two most favourite things for a comic-reading fanboy geek? ! Sexy women and aliens! ! Finally, thank God, Blatant Comics brings the two together. The result is an excellent art-filled comic book nirvana for your reading pleasure. Fuck me.
That one sentence can go fuck itself.
Yeah. And they've got one other book out which I'm going to read, which is Triple X Xena, Warrior Porn Star, issue 1.
No thought of that going into that at all.
No, what's wrong with these people? By day, the fierce warrior princess Triple X Xena fights for truth and justice in a cruel world of Greek mythology. By night, she becomes part of the most successful segment of the entertainment industry, pornography, Join Triple X Xena and her well-endowed co-stars for a parody of epic proportions. How fucking brilliant does that sound? They've got a number of covers. They've got the regular black and white. They've got a nude Greek myth porn cover.
They've got a nude
1970s porn cover. Fuck me, we need to get that.
So that's two comics on the wish list.
Yeah. Essentially, if you can't get all the trading cards in a set, I don't want it.
Yeah. Ended on a high with that one. Oh, I'm glad I spotted that now.
Oh, my word. Can you see how far we've come, folks? I mean, with all of the stuff, all the creators that are doing this interesting stuff. I mean, you look at Image now and what they're doing. It's a different world, isn't it? And all the creators that we know and we've spoken to that have been influenced by, you know, some of these comics that we've talked about, or, you know, maybe even the ones that we've just completely torn to shreds. But the work they're doing now, if it wasn't for this glorious decade, maybe not.
We wouldn't have a lot of stuff now, would we?
Yeah.
We wouldn't have Deadpool movie. You know, there's a lot of stuff that wouldn't be out there, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think you wouldn't get the artists that are coming out today and working on titles without those guys.
Talking about Brian. Brian's heavily influenced by that period, and so I'm sure is Chris Imber. You know, there's a lot of people out there who are doing great work, and you can see that it's reflective of that stuff. You know,
they sort of taking the best of it and put their own spin definitely. On it, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. So comics, gotta love them, and I think it's been a good show to start 2017 with.
Yeah, comics will break your heart. That's a good phrase.
We're starting a year by looking back. but let us know what you thought about what we talked about. Obviously, all of the stuff we talked about in this episode is our opinions. Don't take anything too seriously.
No.
Because, let's face it, if you listen to this show, you know it's just a load of old bollocks.
Fake ideas. Poorly delivered.
But if there's anything you want to know more about, or maybe you just want to rant about the comics that influenced you, let us know. You can email us awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Were you affected by Triple X Xena? then get in touch, tony.awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. And get on the Facebook, folks. We're gonna post up some. Dan's threatened to post up several of the things he's talked about on this episode.
Yeah,
shortly,
you guys see Major Barovo's backs.
So over the next couple of days,
I'll post up. I'll send you some guys from that Spawny Impaler comic.
So there's gonna be lots to see on facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast. Tell everyone about it as well, because we want people to like us. Because, like everything in this social media world, we're whores, and we're looking for love and clickbait. No. Follow us on Twitter at the Awesome Pod. And also for this year, we're going to set up a Facebook. If you do the Facebook groups or things like that, we're going to set up a Facebook sort of community page where it's going to be easier for people to talk about every week. You can go on there and interact. So look for that on the next few days. So we're setting that up. It's going to be easier for people to interact and have their own conversations. So there you go. So we're going to set that up as well. We hope you have a brilliant new year. Welcome to 2017. Yep.
This is the future.
We made it. And thank you, Matt, for joining us.
Yeah, cheers, Matt.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been fun. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this for a while. I'm always trying. I'm always at him to come on as well.
Yeah. Trying to hear your own voice on the recordings is the most terrifying thing I've ever heard in my life. So get me to do that. Yeah.
We just listen to ourselves nonstop on a loop. We stop listening to any other podcasts. We just love listening to ourselves.
That's really, really fucking insane.
Yeah. Tony's in dark. Yeah. Tony's in a room, like his voice on loop. Triple X.
Are you cranky, Tony?
Sorry.
Are you cranking while you're listening to the podcast?
Yeah, always. Yeah, that's why I run you. That's why I suggested we test our mics last night.
Oh, is that what you call it? You dirty pigeons.
I think it took him about 2 hours to get up. I'd had
a busy day.
Doesn't normally happen to you though, does it, Tony?
Not all the time.
It's because I'm not Xenia Warrior Princess Paula.
You know, we're going back issue diving tomorrow. You know what the first thing we're going to be asking Gary for at Krypton Comics is, don't we?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe. A little shout out to Krypton Comics, actually. Best back issues in London. Black Horse Lane, Krypton Comics. Pop down there. Gary runs the place. Top bloke. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice one.
So, where can people find us online and further? Tony?
Ezohyz on Twitter, and I've just put a review up for a really interesting book out of Centrale, who we talked about a few times on the show, called Staring from the Hill. Very interesting stuff. Have a look. It's a bit like Gorillaz, if that makes sense. Have a look at that. Down the Tubes.
Are you talking about the band?
Yeah, or the animation, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, sort of musical, about a punk rock band full of aliens and stuff. It's good.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Nice. Dan, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can be vanguard@vanguardcomic.com.
Very good.
Brilliant. You can find me on Twitter at Jester Diablo. Find out more about my comic at theredmassfrommars.com. And Matt, where can people find out about you and your brilliant artwork?
I'm on Twitter at HP_Matt. Yeah, that's it.
There you go.
Cool.
And he's the world's best Vampirella cosplayer.
Yes.
Yeah, those are private pictures for Tony when he cranks. So,
www.vampirellapeachstone.com.
Don't do that. I'm going to do that now. I'll find out.
Yeah, he's giving it away. He's got to buy the domain first. thank you for listening, folks. Hope you all have a brilliant week. We've got some exciting few weeks coming up, a few months actually, 2017.
Yeah.
So have a brilliant week. Read comics. Have a look back on some of those 90s books you used to love and give them another read, because it's
definitely check out Cap 1.
Yeah.
By yourself that.
Yeah.
Check out all of them. That is the one you have to find.
I think. And then follow it up by reading some Fighting Americans, see what happens to the actual storyline he was drawing. Yeah.
You get the full run, I presume, then.
In a twisted kind of way. Anyway, have a brilliant week, folks. Read comics, and as always, stay awesome. See ya.
See ya.
See ya. Bye.
I like the fact that Debbie Reynolds applied to play herself in the movie Postcards from the Edge, and they turned her down because they said she wasn't right for it. I think that's Hollywood talk for you can't act, Debbie. I think you're a fucking maniac.
You didn't turn down to play yourself. That's fucking brutal.
That's rough, isn't it? Yeah.